Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
At least two high schools around the Chicago area are reprinting their yearbooks. They contain photos of students making hand gestures associated with racist, white power ideology. Anti-hate organizations say incidents like these are on the rise and schools don't know how to handle them. But in Chicago, one teacher is trying to fix this. She has created a resource to help school communities spot and fight back when white nationalism creeps in. WBEZ's Odette Youssef reports.
A couple years ago, Nora Flanagan's son told her he'd found swastikas on the bathroom walls at school. He was in fifth grade.
I asked him if he wanted me to talk to the teachers or the administration, and he was horrified.
So the two of them worked out a deal.
I taught him how to remove Sharpie with an alcohol pad, and he would go in there every day and clean swastikas off the bathroom wall with an alcohol wipe. And I said, why do you want to do that instead of tell the administration? And he said, the cleaning staff and the building engineer are African-American and Latino, and I don't want them to see it.
Flanagan really knows about this kind of thing. Growing up in the Irish-American stronghold of Beverly on Chicago's southwest side, she witnessed the rise of a neo-Nazi movement in the late 80s. She fought it then, and she fights it now as a teacher at Chicago Public Schools. Over the years, she's seen students get lost down the path of white nationalism. And yet, Flanagan regrets how she handled her son's situation.
I should have gone to the administrator. Looking back 2 years later, looking at how much worse things have become in school communities, I should have gone right to the principal. She's wonderful. But I didn't know what to do.
A spokesperson for Chicago Public Schools claimed the district tracks hate and bias incidents, but she could provide no numbers. Flanagan says hearing from other teachers, there's no question there's been a rise. And the Southern Poverty Law Center is seeing the same thing.
We're seeing them across the United States, and we're also seeing that schools really don't know quite what to do.
Maureen Costello directs the SPLC's Teaching Tolerance Project. In 2016, the SPLC started surveying thousands of teachers. It asked how the 2016 election was affecting students and schools. Overwhelmingly, teachers said they witnessed an increase in incidents targeting African Americans, immigrants, Jews, Muslims, and LGBTQ people. The SPLC called it the Trump effect. Costello says schools have been treating these incidents as simple acts of bullying. They focus on identifying and punishing the offender. Costello says that's not enough.
What they don't focus on necessarily are the before and the after. And the before, of course, is where is this coming from and how have we failed to educate students about, for instance, the history of the Holocaust and the history of anti-Semitism in this country? Why haven't we educated them about the history of white supremacy and racism in this country? And then the after part is how do we heal the wounds?
This is why Nora Flanagan co-authored a toolkit. It's titled Confronting White Nationalism in Schools. A nonprofit in Oregon publishes it. The toolkit considers many ways the issue presents itself in schools. Graffiti of swastikas and slurs, hate speech online, students citing white nationalist sources in class, or even forming white student unions. Flanagan thought about all stakeholders, not just the perpetrators or their targets.
When a kid Sig Heils in the cafeteria, yes, I want to know what's going on with that kid. I absolutely want to talk to whoever he was pointing it at, but I want to talk to the kid that was sitting 50 feet away and saw it, and then it was never spoken of again.
Take the instance that Flanagan's son encountered, swastikas in the bathroom. Here's some of what the toolkit prescribes. Students, document the graffiti and report it to staff. Staff, consider providing aftercare for kids and groups that may feel targeted. Administrators, try implementing a confidential online system for students to report such incidents. The main takeaways are engage the whole school community and act fast.
Context of white supremacy. Act Fast. Very important. Love that recommendation. Have a sense of urgency about resolving the problem of white supremacy, racism as soon as possible. Act fast. Today's date, Monday, March 30, 2020. So I have been told. We are doing our diligence with Chicago. The news report you just heard, talking about some of the incidents in Chicago's public schools. We have our book club this Thursday. We're almost at the conclusion, packing them in. Dr. Sylvia Hood Washington's book on environmental racism, specifically in the city of Chicago, the long history of environmental racism. We've done all this about Bubbly Creek and what have you in the city of Chicago. We read in the book club previously, Dreams from My Father. President Obama's autobiography. We had Beryl Satter on the program, her book Family Property, which details the history of white property ownership, and she called it economic terrorism, and not just what they call segregation and warehousing black people in specific locations of the city, but charging them like exorbitant rent for really poor quality housing, fire traps, they call them. And even her father, Beryl Satter, was one of these white property owners, even though he was trying to call attention to this and how horrible this was and confining people to these types of conditions. Lots of even I'd even put in terms of our body of work on Chicago, Leonita McLean from the book club, A Foot in Each World. She was a journalist with the Chicago Tribune, one of the first black journalists with the Chicago Tribune. She chronicled in her book the election of Mayor Harold Washington. Wowee. The report that she has talking about that election and the hatred that she saw in the city during the 1980s when Harold Washington was elected the first mayor of Chicago. President Obama talked about that as well. Lots of it, even The Warmth of Other Suns. Isabel Wilkerson, Chicago. It talks about many different cities, but Chicago is featured prominently because that's one of the big spots, big locations for black people during the Great Migration. So Chicago, very important city. We have covered quite a bit of commentary on that city over the years. Although the report that we're going to talk about today is not specifically focused on Chicago, white supremacy, racism in schools is a problem nationwide, worldwide, really, but just a slight lean, one of the authors being in the Chicago area, so a little bit of a lean to what we're talking about. Anywho, anyone who has listened to The Cows for any length of time, you have heard us say racist man, racist woman, racist child. We've talked about that for years. I have said white people cannot be ignorant about racism. There's lots of evidence of this. And one is you can look at the conduct of white children. I almost went with a montage of different incidents of reports from schools, white children practicing acts of racism, white supremacy. They had the incident in Phoenix that we talked more about where it was a group of white girls. They were in high school, 16, 17 in that age group, and they had on shirts that had letters, and they arranged themselves to spell out the word nigger. This one, remember this one? Not too long ago. Tons of these types of incidents in the classroom, and I point that out. They're learning. Even at this young age, they're not ignorant about racism. A few weeks back, I was listening to the news. Always encourage folks, check out the news when you can. They generally often are talking about white supremacy, racism, directly or indirectly. I was checking out the news, and they had a report on this toolkit, Confronting White Nationalism in Our Schools. And they went through some of the suggestions, and they were talking about, you know, what motivated the report. You heard some of that in the audio clip that we started with. And I thought, wow, that would be great to have the authors on the program. Always think it's important to address this, particularly because I know we have a lot of black parents, non-white parents who listen to this program. And I try to emphasize as often as possible, you have to talk to your children about racism. These incidents are going to come up. Things are going to happen. And it is a dereliction. You are in dereliction of your duty as an attempted counter-racist parent if you're not talking to your offspring about racism, white supremacy. And sexual abuse, by the way, but You have to talk to them about these things so that they are not blindsided, so that, you know, unfortunately, if these things happen, they already have a framework, an understanding of what is taking place, and they have suggestions on what they should do, what you as a parent would want your child to do, like, oh, boom, I'm supposed to call mom or go report this to administrator, and boom, boom, boom. They already have kind of a protocol, and that makes it, I think, a little bit less traumatic, as opposed to something happens and you don't know, you're trying to make sense of it, and you're kind of flailing, and do I say something, and am I kind of to blame for this, and that sort of thing. You have to talk to your children about racism, and if you have resources out there that can make it more manageable, then whoopee. We'll evaluate to see if that's what we have here. The report again, it is Confronting White Nationalism in Schools, a Toolkit, published by the Western States Center. You can download a copy online if you just want an e-version. It's pretty short, not very long, won't take you a long time to read. If you want a physical copy, you can send in a small fee, and they'll send in a physical copy if you're an educator or someone and you would prefer to have it in hand. Let's see. We should have multiple authors. There are three different authors for the report, and I think we have at least two of them with us. Let's see. We'll try out number one. Nora Flanagan, one of the authors of the report. Are you with us?
I am. Hi.
Greetings. Thank you so much for sharing a bit of your Monday evening with us. And let's see. One of the other co-authors of the report, Miss Jessica Asai. Are you with us as well, ma'am?
Yep, it's AC, and I'm happy AC to be here with you both.
My apologies, Jessica Asai. Thank you so much,
no
both
worries.
Of you, for sharing a bit of your time. Wowee, it does seem for anyone who is listening in at this time to be talking about this report when most of the schools across the land are closed. I could certainly see how some folks might say this is a tad misguided. And, you know, why aren't you talking about more important things and suggestions on how to stay safe during all this? I at least will take a moment to check in. I believe, Ms. Flanagan, you're calling in from Chicago. Is that correct?
Yes, I teach in the Chicago Public Schools.
Awesome. Before we get to the work, just because we've got such a incredible event happening worldwide, what's the status in Chicago, Illinois right now? Are you all on shelter in place, stay at home? Are school shut down right now, and for how long?
So the state of Illinois is on shelter in place, and the Chicago public schools, as well as every school system around Chicago, we are shut down currently through April 20th, but most people anticipate a longer closure.
Okay. Before I check in with Ms. AC, here in Washington State, schools are closed down, I believe, until the 26th, although a good number of folks say they don't think it's going to resume at all this school year. Are you confident that it's going to resume at all, or do you think that this whole academic year is going to be a wash?
Well, I wouldn't say that the year will be a wash. Chicago right now is transitioning to remote learning models, and we're getting tech out to students who don't yet have access to it because, as I'm sure you know, there's a considerable equity gap in technology. So we're working on it so that our students don't lose a lot of ground. But as far as being physically back in the buildings, 7 states, I believe, have already called it for the year, and I think more will follow. I don't know what to expect at this point. I'm mostly worried about my students and their families having what they need.
Excellent point. Before I move to Ms. AC, I think that's a really important point. We talked about that a little bit this weekend in terms of access and a lot of the issues, so-called racial disparities that people talk about in education. Many folks are saying I think they will be greatly exacerbated during all of this in terms of who has Wi-Fi, who has a tablet or a device to do the remote learning. In fact, I think we had a parent dial in this weekend, and she said that the plan that was given in her district, I think she was in Florida, I might be wrong about the state, but I think it was Florida, she said that they acknowledged that there was a huge gap in terms of non-white students having access to Wi-Fi and or devices. And so the strategy that they developed was to turn up the school's Wi-Fi signal a little bit stronger, and they told parents to drive to the school parking lot, park, and have students do their work from the parking lot. that was the best strategy they could come up with. But
just
if you could, can you speak to, you know, how you think the disparity may be exacerbated during this uncertain time?
So I mean, we're seeing the same thing in Chicago, that and it's the thing is, it's a gap that we knew was there, and that entities like the Chicago Teachers Union and other, you know, community entities had been shouting at the top of our lungs about, and we kept being told, yeah, we'll get to it, we'll get to it, we'll get to it. Well, all of a sudden, there's this situation where we can't push it off anymore, and it's going to determine how, you know, the rest of this school year goes for some students versus others. So I won't go so far as to say that in that respect there's, you know, a silver lining, but it is pushing the conversation forward in a way that teachers and community groups have been trying to do for years. So it's laid it out in a way that can't be ignored. There are some efforts to, like I said, get that tech to the families that don't have it, to get portable hotspots to folks that don't have Wi-Fi. There are Wi-Fi companies offering 60 days of free Wi-Fi. But getting that implemented and making that actually happen, messy process, but we're working on it.
Much obliged, Nora Flanagan in Chicago. Miss AC, where are you calling us from?
I'm calling you from Portland, Oregon.
Portland, okay. I'm in Seattle, right down the road. I've been to Portland. Wowee.
Practically neighbors.
Yes, yes. Socially distanced neighbors. Are you?
Yeah.
You're an educator. You are an educator.
I work at a Catholic high school here in Portland, and we're in a slightly different situation. The school is actually quite racially diverse and quite economically diverse, and we're funded by tuition dollars and grants and other means of fundraising, but we're operating at a much smaller scale. So all of our students have at least an iPad, if not more. And we were able to offer students who needed them Wi-Fi hotspots before the school closed down.
Wow. Enormous difference.
It's a huge difference. It's a huge difference.
And I will add, because we talked about this regularly, how could we not talk about Oregon, me being right here in Seattle? Part of that difference, don't you think it is an accident? The same reason that I say Seattle is the best plantation in the known universe. Don't you think for a second that that is an accident? Oregon is a state where it was in the state constitution. They forbid black people from being residents. And to this day, they still have substantially fewer black people than are in the state of Illinois or in Oregon. And there are lots of direct white supremacist legal reasons as to why that is the case, even though they've acknowledged this and done tacky housing programs to try to correct this and what have you. No surprise, they would have sparkling school systems like that and those type of resources, same type of differential here in Seattle. Go ahead.
Yes, I was just going to say, we're a private school, so we're not a model of the sparkly resources that that the city of Portland public schools has access to, nor are we, a model of or an example of what the state of Oregon looks like in terms of education. We're one of the poorest states in the country. Portland public schools are consistently ranked lower. You know, we spend more money per student than the Chicago public schools, and we get worse results. So, my school isn't a model for how things are going in the state, but you're absolutely right. It was designed to be a white state, and it's largely stayed that way. Portland is the whitest major city in America.
Wow. I would still interrogate their academic results a tad, but you are at a private school. That is super important to point out. They are going to have substantially better resources.
Yeah, it's very different.
Anywhere with a private school, substantially better resources. Wow. What is the status in Oregon? Are you on shelter in place, stay at home? What are you all?
We are, yep. We are on shelter in place through the end of April. April 28th would be the first day that Governor Brown has said that we might return to school. So we're all, we're all home and doing remote learning as best we can, and eager to see how things play out in our state, and of course hopeful for, for everybody to stay healthy and be well, and concerned for folks without income right now. It's not a good time.
Absolutely. You said April 21st, that's the resume date?
28th.
28th. Okay. Are you all
April 28th?
Mm-hmm. April 28th. Are you all thinking it's going to be feasible to finish out the school year, or is this going to be the same type of thing, not really academic, I mean, remote learning type thing?
I mean, we're doing a decent job. I'm very proud of my school in terms of what we've been able to accomplish with the remote learning. It's not ideal. Obviously, everyone would rather be back in school, and I'm sure I'm reading probably the same things that you and Nora are, and your listeners are, around potential timelines for this. So I think, you know, we'll just have to wait and see and hope people stay inside and hope it slows the curve. And, you know, I'm not sure.
Lots of uncertainty. Absolutely. Highlight that one. Certainly, lots could be said about the virus and the shutdown and all that. We'll have more time to chat on that. But I do think this report is important. I think at some point the schools will reopen and the same issues that we had before this pandemic will In fact, it's not been called the pandemic. It's been called the Chinese virus. So I'm very sure these issues will resurface once everybody gets back in schools. For folks who have not, maybe this is their first time hearing from both of you, Ms. AC and Ms. Flanagan, you both are white women?
I'm a person of color, Jessica here.
Ms. AC, that was you? You said you're a person of color?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Could we be more specific? What's your racial classification?
Sure. I'm Arab. I identify as biracial.
You said you identify as biracial? You said you're Arab and you identify as biracial?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. May I ask what your parents' racial classification, your mom and dad?
Sure. But I'd love to hear why, too, after I tell you. So my dad is an immigrant from Lebanon, and my mom identifies as white, and her parents come from Eastern Europe.
Okay. Okay. So you have, would it be correct to say you have one white parent and one non-white parent?
That would be correct.
Okay. My reason for asking that question, you said, I do think it's important in terms of knowing the racial classification of the person I'm talking to in any situation, if I can see the person or not, especially this is a phone interview, so I can't see you all. But I think that information is important because if I say I'm talking to a non-white person and I think, oh, okay, I'm talking to a non-white person, two black parents or whatever it is, a non-white person, two Asian parents, whatever it is, and I'm talking to a non-white person who actually has one white parent and one non-white parent, I have concluded that that has a huge impact on a non-white person's thinking and understanding. If you actually have a white parent, that greatly impacts your understanding of what it means to be white. You have an intimate biological connection. It's not just emotional. You have an intimate biological and emotional connection to a white person and white people, period, that is very different than someone who has two biological non-white parents. And that is manifested often greatly in conversations on racism, white supremacy, and talking about these issues. Does that make sense? Is it logical?
No, it absolutely makes sense. I hope we'll have more time one of these days to dive into that.
Awesome. So that's excellent to keep in mind as we proceed. So one of our authors, guests for the report, Ms. AC, non-white, Ms. Flanagan, you're a white woman. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Excellent to keep in mind. I thought we had to white people. That is not the case. So I'm glad that's why I always ask, make sure I'm not confused. So sometimes you can see things and get incorrect information. So I always ask to make sure I'm clear. One white person, one non-white person. Great. I start all of our broadcast definitions, and you all had that in the report. I appreciated it. So I'll read your definition as well. But I start all of our programs, the term racism, the term white supremacy. I use these words as synonyms. And I use the same definition for both terms. The definition I use is as follows: a global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you think such a system exists? Do you think that definition is accurate?
So I'm an English teacher, so I love words, and I love talking about definitions and pulling them apart. You had me at your use of the phrase "in the known universe." I think that was the part of your definition that I have not heard a version of, and I like it. I agree with the idea of it being vast and systemic, and I didn't catch if you had something in the definition as far as it being conscious or unconscious. I tend to think it is both sometimes at the same time. But yes, I like your definition. Jessica, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, agreed. I think that's a good place to start. And our work and the toolkit centers around white nationalism, and we have a slightly different way of approaching it. But absolutely, if we're talking about the foundation of our country, of racist systems, I think this is a good place to start.
Mm. They call it the Chinese virus. Known universe. And you all pointed out you have a different definition, different framework. And pause, I've said this for 11 years. People can go all the way back in the archives, 2009, when we came back on the air. Words, very important. Words are a critical component of how the system of racism, white supremacy operates. You have to be skilled with words. I have tremendous regard for white people who are English professors. That's why Dr. Martin Kevorkian, he's a professor at the University of Texas, Austin. He's an English professor, doctorate in English, so extremely skilled with the use of language. We've had many interesting conversations about terms. But on page 6 of the toolkit, you all write, while white nationalism is a bigoted social movement, white supremacy is a system designed to maintain control over people of color and the rights of all women. Why did you think it was important early in the toolkit to make a distinction between white nationalism and white supremacy?
Go ahead, Nora.
I was just going to say, our definition of white supremacy as a system is not that different from the way you defined it. But the difference between white supremacy and white nationalism is white supremacy is a belief system and white nationalism is a political effort. Jessica, is that a good starting point?
Yeah, I think that's a great starting point. And, you know, we really, when we talk about this, when we give workshops to other teachers or students or folks in the community, we really hammer home that white nationalist groups, as they stand now, are diverse. It's a diverse movement. There are a range of different kind of groups and with different numbers of people making up their core and with different strategies and tactics, but building political power is at the core of what they do.
Okay.
And towards the end of what they do, like their kind of end game is, and we put this in the toolkit as well, their end game is an all-white ethno-state. And some of them are approaching that through Islamophobia. Some of them are approaching that through xenophobia and anti-immigrant efforts. And some of them, you know, it's just, as you said, hating anybody who's not white and favoring policies that take away their power and their rights. So it's that jump from belief to tangible goals and efforts.
Okay. Thank you both for the responses. We normally only have one guest on at a time, so I'm having to work a little bit. Now we have two people to get our responses. But I did not use the word hate, and that is an important one. I generally don't use the word hate when talking about racism, white supremacy, because that can be hard to define and or prove. In my definition, I said abuse and subjugate non-white people, not hate. For myself, that's an important distinction. I also want to point out that you said, I believe that was Nora. You all want me to do just first names, Jessica, Nora? Is that acceptable?
Because you all sure. Oh, yeah, that's great.
Cool. We'll do first names. You all, I think it was Nora, had said that you all's definition of white supremacy is similar to mine. And I just want to make sure I get on the record. It is not. There's an enormous difference, really two big differences. Mine system of, or there, I guess there might be at least three, system of people classified as white. For me, that's very important because I've concluded that most of the time when people talk about racism, white supremacy, when they say institutional racism or systemic racism, they'll go to policies, laws, statutes. A lot of times they'll talk about things that happened 100 years ago or thousands of years ago. Rarely are they talking about things that white people are doing right now, March 30, 2020, as we speak, things that these people are doing to maintain. That's very rare. So that's an important distinction. I try to make it very specific that what we're talking about is individuals classified as white doing things. That's one. Two, people of color. I just don't use that term. I could talk about that later. Three, this is the biggest one, and rights of all women. I pay attention because it's not even constructed the same. It's not try to maintain control over people of color and all women. It's maintain control over people of color and the rights of all women, which is very distinct. That would include the rights of white women as well. Is that accurate?
It would, yes. And it's we've intentionally included that because misogyny is such a core component of white nationalism.
Switch to white nationalism, not white supremacy. Okay. I would, if you all could explain that, and I guess I would go with Nora, since you are a white woman, the rights of white women, that's white supremacy, is to control the rights of white women. What does that mean exactly?
So as Jessica was saying, the research into white nationalist groups and organized white supremacist organizations through their history in the United States, which is the history of the United States, the subjugation of women has always been a huge part of it. There's really great research by, and I would have to pull up my list of the folks doing this research, about the roles of women in white nationalist and white supremacist movements. Jessica, I know you know them a little better than I do. I will turn it over to you.
Kathleen Blee is a great person to look up.
Thank you. I was going to get her last name wrong because I'm a little cooked right now with everything going on with the schools, but
don't worry.
Misogyny is integral to white nationalist movements. So that was why we included it. It's similarly in the opening pages of the toolkit where we kind of, as briefly as can be done, introduce the issue. We talk about how misogyny is a part of it. So is homophobia and transphobia. So are other forms of subjugation. They all kind of go part and parcel to this idea that there is, you know, this belief and these actions toward the idea that there is one group of people that should be in charge and that America is for them. And women are never really included in those who deserve power.
This question is for... Was that, Jessica, were you going to add something?
It was. I apologize. I think I'm hearing you on a little bit of a delay. I was just going to say, especially in the work that we do around white nationalism in schools, hate in schools, misogyny is a key recruitment tool of white nationalists. Often you'll see them online talking to young folks in chat rooms or on, you know, message boards or whatever. And misogyny comes out loud and clear. Like you white young men are entitled to the respect of women. You're entitled to date sex with women. This sort of idea that women should serve you in some way, and that if that's not happening, you can join their movement. You are being, you're being discriminated against in some way by a lack of attention. Those are core messages that come out a lot in their recruitment efforts, and we want to make sure people know what that looks like so that our young people aren't vulnerable to it.
Got it. Okay. Question for Nora. Do white women practice racism, white supremacy?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. Sorry. I'm trying not to answer that too loudly, but absolutely. I think that, and to go back to what Jessica just said, I think that our inclusion of misogyny as a core issue in the toolkit is not so much because the group being wronged most or more or even, it's not on a scale even, is women. It's more, like she said, misogyny and hostility toward women of all backgrounds is a key recruitment component and a key kind of, it's almost like the gateway drug of white nationalism is to get alienated young white men on kind of misogyny angles.
Okay. Just making sure for our listeners, they were talking a lot about white nationalism and misogyny being a tool of recruitment for a lot of these white nationalist movements, and saying that you talking to young white men, frustrated young white men, presumably, and, you know, you're entitled to women and they should be listening to you, and that type of thing. The definition in the toolkit for white supremacy is a system designed to maintain control over people of color and the rights of all women, and that would include white women. In my view, that is not an accurate definition, way of conceptualizing racism, white supremacy. You cannot have a system of white supremacy without white women being equal participants. White men and white women brawl and fight. White men brawl and fight with each other all the time. White women brawl and fight with each other all the time. But their unifying concept is what I said at the beginning, dominating, abusing everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. And even other literature, I think they were her property. Excellent book. I'm hoping we can get the author as a guest on the program sometime soon. Stephanie Jones Rogers, Black Female, where she talks about the role of white women in slavery. I've found many of the ways that conceptualize racism, white supremacy as white men, and placing white women as victims. A lot of times it takes away their agency as racists, where we don't see them as racists. We see them as victims of some sort of white patriarchy, male supremacy, those type of terms, those types of ways of conceptualizing it. It's, for me, it's not just that it's inaccurate, it's dangerous. And I would pivot to just one piece of evidence, what we're talking about, the school system. Before the Chinese virus crisis, people were talking about the prison to school to prison pipeline. Unless I've been misinformed, it's approximately 70% of the educators, K through 12, U.S. public schools, are white women. Are those numbers accurate, in the ballpark, close to your knowledge, Nora?
Yes.
Okay. That would be an example. Yes. I would take. If there is such a thing, school to prison pipeline, white women would have to be at the forefront of this problem of shuffling young black children, predominantly young black male children, shuffling them off to prison. That can't be something that can just be pawned off. This is white men oppressing us and making us do this. No, this would have to be a lot of white teachers, white women, K through 12, that are doing this. Is what I'm saying, is it logical? Certainly, you can tell me if I'm wrong, if I'm giving out inaccurate information.
I hear what you're saying, and go ahead, Jessica.
I was just going to say, this is not a, this is not my specific area of expertise, but I think we can approach it with a little bit more nuance. I totally hear what you're saying, but the school to prison pipeline, for example, is not something that operates only within the classroom where there's a white teacher and perhaps a black student. I mean, these are systems that have, they're complicated systems. They involve state and local government, they involve lawmakers, they involve school districts and their rules around, what's appropriate behavior and what's not, and what's punishable and what's not. Often women are not in control of all of those systems. So I would say, well, yes, there certainly are, white women have played and continue to play their role in white supremacy. For our purpose in including that in this definition, and I'm just to bring it back to the toolkit, We value looking at all the angles of ways that our young people are being recruited by white nationalists. And if that's one of the angles that the white nationalists are using, if that's a key core component of their recruitment, then we should include it.
Nora, you were going to respond. And again, it's not beating a record. Words are important. She's talking about recruitment tools for white nationalism. I'm talking about a definition for white supremacy racism. Some of the confusion is different words. Got to be very clear. Recruiting tool for white nationalism, that's what Jessica just addressed, which is all fine. I'm talking about definition for system of racism, white supremacy. Nora, you were going to respond?
I genuinely agree with Jessica's explanation as far as, and this would have to be a whole other interview, because I would love to talk about the school to prison pipeline. I teach in Chicago and I've lived here my whole life. Like, this is starting, by the way, sidebar, and I promise, just for like 15 seconds, the books you were listing that you all have been discussing and reading, I jotted down the ones I haven't read yet and was nodding vigorously about the ones that I have that are focused on Chicago. And there's a couple more that I want to email you about. Have you read The South Side by Natalie Moore?
No, ma'am.
Oh, okay. Add that to your list because that's another great book about the history of policy in Chicago and housing discrimination and incarceration rates and more. This is something that is a huge part of my job, my life, what I care about in my city. But as far as what we were doing with the toolkit, we were looking at the role of misogyny in recruiting for white nationalist groups. I do understand that you're talking about like the nuanced parts of definitions of racism and white supremacy, and I'm not diminishing the importance of each aspect of a definition. Just I think all we were trying to explain is the reason we brought up the role of gender with regard to the toolkit is because it is such a huge part of how these groups get their hooks into kids in a school setting, on the internet, and in other contexts.
Okay. Much obliged for the response. Let's see. Nora is in Chicago. There are three different authors to this report, and I think they're all in different locations. But Nora is in Chicago. Jessica is in Oregon. And this was published with the Western States Center. Like, what was the publication process for this toolkit? I have found that can be interesting sometimes for books on racism. So what was the publication process for getting this book or this toolkit published to talk about racism? I guess we can start with Jessica.
Sure. So the Western State Center is a great organization. I hope your listeners will look them up if they don't know already about their work. They're a national civil rights organization based here in Portland, Oregon, with a focus on building democracy and confronting hate nationally. And so Nora and I partnered with Lindsay Schubner, who's the Momentum Program Director at Western State Center. Momentum is their countering white nationalist program. And we are the three co-authors of the toolkit. We got together the summer of 2018, Nora?
Yes.
And we spent one whirlwind weekend writing, and then we made a point to share our draft with as many educators and parents and students and principals and et cetera, librarians, school counselors, as we possibly could to get feedback and make edits and make changes. The toolkit came out in January of 2019, and then about 6 months later, we released a second edition because we added a section for what to do or what steps you could potentially take if you're confronted with an adult at your school who's advancing white nationalist language, actions, rhetoric. So that was our main edition for the second edition, and the toolkit's been shared over 10,000 times, all states, a number of countries outside of the U.S. too, and we're really proud of how it's been helpful for folks.
Spectacular. What was the budget for getting this published? Because it's not very long, and I think you all said that was deliberate, so it wouldn't be something that would take people months to get through. Like, if they're having these problems, it can be quick. The resources are right there. It doesn't take you all day to read, and even a younger person can read and interpret, so I appreciate making it accessible so they don't have to take all day to get the information.
Yeah, thank you. We really did want it to be user-friendly. We wanted it to be student-centered. We wanted to be able to get hard copies in the hands of teachers, and I appreciate that you mentioned that at the beginning of the show, that folks can order a hard copy. We hope that the suggestions are broad enough that folks can find something that works for them in their own school community. I have no idea what the budget was, honestly. Our other co-author, Lindsay, would have to be on the call to be able to answer that.
I see. Okay. The edition that I read was one of, or I guess the first edition. So the second edition, you said you all had to address what to do, give some suggestions if it's an adult, a staff member who might be the one who's perpetrating acts of racism, white supremacy. We had a parent, I was trying to think of multiple. I can think of at least one, but I felt like there was more recent, but I can't think of that one. So I'll go with the one that I can recall. We had a parent in Georgia, and her daughter was at school. She was high school, so like 15, 16. She said she's in a class. She had a white female teacher. And the teacher had the Confederate flag on her desk. and I think there were other
other
non-white students in class. They didn't, you know, they didn't really pay attention to it. So her daughter, she saw it and was like, oh, wow, that's, you know, that shouldn't be like, you know, what's going on. So she tells her mom, and her mom said, what I said, you got to talk to your children about racism, because when these things happen, you don't want to be blindsided. So she tells her mom says, okay, if she has the thing out, you say something, report. So she goes, says something, and then I think she does take it down. The teacher does takes it down, but then it becomes punitive, like, oh, you tried to tell your mom to get me in trouble, like retaliation type of a thing for telling on me. Like it did, it didn't improve things. It did not make the situation any better. So what would be a recommendation for a parent in that type of situation?
Ooh, Jessica, can I take this one?
Yeah, please.
Sorry. And if the story reminded me of something that happened at a Chicago public high school fairly recently, where a student was protesting the anthem by not standing, and that student, who was actually was two female students, one African American, one Latinx, and the white teacher told one of them that she should go back where she came from, and the other, I can't remember exactly what he said to her, but it was actually worse. Those are all three, your story and the things said to these young women, that is a staff member perpetuating white nationalism. That is a staff member expressing white nationalism. And when we wrote the first edition of the toolkit, like you said, we wanted to keep it as short as possible to make it accessible, to make it something that you could hand to your administrator and say, we need to talk about some things, or to, you know, get it in the mail out to whoever needs it without it costing a lot. So that was one of the sections that in the first edition we decided, I don't think we really need a section about white nationalism from staff members, do we? Yeah, it turns out we do, because this stuff happens all the time. And there isn't, people don't feel like they have a dependable, safe way to report it without, as you mentioned, encountering retaliation. So in a situation like that with the Confederate flag, that's horrible. That would be one of those incidents where, as we suggest in the toolkit, if the school had an online reporting system where either the student or the parent or a group of students or another staff member could go on and say, this is happening and we need to talk about it, and then let the administration take it from there. The online reporting systems that I know of at a number of schools, including my own, anytime anything is reported, it automatically goes to every member of the administration and one of the counselors, because that's another idea that we push a lot in the toolkit, is that you have to tell multiple people anytime something happens, because you tell one person, they could shrug it off, or they could get too busy, or they could not respond well. But if you have multiple people hearing about an incident and hearing that there's something that needs to be addressed in the school community, you have a much better chance of it being effectively addressed, including the whole school community. So for starters, I would say a reporting tool that doesn't put that student or that parent in the spotlight for potential retaliation. I would also say every school needs a culture and climate team or an equity committee. They have different names at different schools, but essentially a group of staff members and students and administrators and counselors representing across the school community that discuss these issues on a regular basis, not just when something terrible happens. My culture and climate team meets once a month, more often if we need to. We have a student equivalent called the Student Voice Committee, where that's where we hear about a lot of things that are going on, is when the students will talk about it with each other at these Student Voice Committee meetings, and we hear about things we had no idea were happening. Sorry, this is a long answer to your question, but right out of the three things, a reporting tool, a culture and climate team, and a student voice committee to hear these issues and make sure they get addressed more effectively.
Did you have something to add to that, Jessica?
Not a thing. Nora covered it perfectly.
Okay.
Oh, thanks, friend.
I know it can be again, you have to talk to your offspring about these issues. I think reporting it to multiple people, I think, is really important to minimize the likelihood of just this being minimized or ignored. Report to multiple people, I think, great one. Add that. I think you all also had one suggestion. If it's a student and the perpetrator is another student, it might not always be best to go and confront that individual immediately. I know some people have more of that active energy and wouldn't have a problem going to say something if they heard them saying nigger or writing a swastika or something of that nature. But one of the suggestions you all have, this is from page 23, as tempting as it might be, don't confront the students involved. At this point, your classmates may be fully involved with a violent extremist organization, and confrontation is not a safe option. I'm not sure if everybody would think that immediately, that this 14-year-old, 13-year-old, 16-year-old might be affiliated with some violent thugs who might do you some harm for even coming to question them about this. Anything you all want to add to that one, Jessica?
Sure. Well, that specific suggestion is under the students category, and it's for a more advanced or more significant scenario. So we're not, this wouldn't be a suggested response for someone who encounters somebody spray painting a swastika on the gym door, or, you know, scratching the N-word into their desk or something like that. This would be a student who has already been recruited by an organized white nationalist group and is bringing that to their school campus. You know, Nora and I work at schools. I'm sure many of your listeners, you know, work at schools or can relate or have children or are in the school system somehow. But, you know, our first oath is to protect for the safety of our students. So we want everyone to be safe. It's part of the reason that it's so important to tell multiple people. You know, we have to make sure that the folks who should know about this and who can intervene safely can best intervene safely. You know, I think it so much here depends on the scenario that you're working with. And so we hope the toolkit is helpful to folks who are listening, who might be having these situations at your school, because there are a number of suggested approaches you can take, and one might feel right for you and another one might not quite fit your situation. But at the end of the day, you know, we want our students to be safe.
Anything to add, Nora?
I would agree that, you know, safety is a priority. And also, as Jessica mentioned, the toolkit is set up for different categories of incidents. And as you go through the toolkit, I'm sure you saw the incidents get more serious. So, yeah, once we're talking about someone who is engaging with a hate group online, who is, you know, representing white nationalist ideology overtly in school, we might be talking about someone who is involved at a level where they're encountering discussions of violence, they're encountering encouragement to act in their school community. So we want to make sure that students especially don't feel like it's their obligation to confront directly, because not only is it not their obligation, it's not a student's job to keep their school community safe. It's the grown-up's job. We want to make sure that students know they can bring in adults to have it handled more safely and more effectively.
Mm. Context of white supremacy. We are discussing the confronting white nationalism in our schools, a toolkit. We have some of the co-authors with us. Man, should have said this a long time ago. If we have parents, you should get on the line right now. If you have scenarios that you would like suggestions or have a thought on how best to proceed, get on the line right now. The number is 605-313-5164. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Parents, definitely dial in if you have a situation, thought, or if you have thoughts on what's been discussed with the broadcast thus far. One of the terms a listener coined down in Florida, racial focal pointing. A term that I have been using for a while, courtesy of that listener. And that term, it basically means it's a practice. We're in a system of white supremacy racism, as I've defined. And what will happen is there will be discussion about racism, and it will say that these racists or these are the racists, and they'll be talking about Richard Spencer, or they'll be talking about Dylann Roof, or whomever the person is for the day. And it'll be, these are the racists. This Dylann Roof fella here, this is the racist or this small group of people here, the Klan, whatever it is, conservatives, sometimes that's what they'll say, old conservative Republicans, a lot of times that'll just be old white men. This small enclave here is the racist. We term that racial focal pointing, meaning that it's narrowing greatly the number of individuals classified as white who are responsible for this system, as opposed to we can't have a system of white supremacy racism without there being a substantial number of individuals classified as white. Like, it would have to be way more than just a few Klan members, a few, you know, staunch old Republicans, and that's, it would have to be substantially more than that if this is dominating the known universe as stated in the definition. I think that's really dangerous. It's kind of that same thing I said before about if you give a definition of racism where white women are not included, it's minimizing, it's distorting what it means to be white. And I think that, at least for me, in this dialogue is important. When we're talking about white nationalism, in the book, you all have suggestions about dealing with so-called bias. If people are giving Richard Spencer, this is a white man who's given a lot of so-called white nationalist views, if they write an essay and they cite Richard Spencer as a source, or they give a quote from Stormfront, this is one of these racist websites, you'll have tips for saying, hey, you can adjust the guidelines for papers to say, hey, this is an acceptable source. This is not an acceptable source. Richard Spencer is not an acceptable source, and this is why. You can have a dialogue around that, which is great. But I said, if we're in a system of racism, white supremacy, it's not racial focal pointing. The racists are not Richard Spencer. I could quote Congressman Louis Gohmert. I could quote Congressman Mo Brooks, who said that there's a war against white people. I could quote President Thomas Jefferson. There are lots of white people that I could quote to espouse racist white supremacist views. I could totally ignore Stormfront and Richard Spencer and all the rest and articulate the exact same views. What would your response to that be? I'll get both of you. We'll start with Nora.
So I disagree with absolutely nothing you just said. Agree, agree, agree. One of the points in our process, before, as Jessica mentioned, we locked ourselves up in a conference room and wrote for 3 days straight, we actually worked remotely between our two cities online to make sure we were creating a resource that was needed and that didn't already exist. Because one of the things we found, there are incredible resources out there to deal with racism from every angle, microaggressions, bias in curriculum, bias from teachers, bias, in every aspect of our lives, because racism exists in every aspect of our lives. Do not disagree at all. We wanted to create a resource for the angle that wasn't being covered yet, which is the active efforts of white nationalist organizations to recruit kids and to get them to share their ideologies at school. So while I agree with absolutely everything you said, we were, as far as our focus point, we were focusing on these white nationalist organizations and their very specific efforts. That's not to say implicit bias and historic racism and systemic racism and all manner of racist behaviors and ideologies are not important. They just weren't being covered as far as resources in a school setting. So I agree with you. We just were focusing on this very specific slice of the issue.
Jessica? Did you have anything to add, Jessica? Oh, oh, did we lose her? Not sure. Not hearing Jessica.
Are you still there?
Yes.
Oh, I'm here.
Oh. Okay.
I agree with Nora. I think, to your earlier point about how widespread this is, there's a University of Virginia study that came out, it might be a year and a half old at this point, around white nationalism, that while the percentage of people who identify as, who publicly identify as part of the white nationalist movement is very small, the number of Americans who agree with one or more of the core tenets of white nationalism is over 30%. And so I think, when for anyone who's ever monitored or tried to confront hate groups or hate movements in our country, there's constantly an uphill battle fighting against this idea of an isolated incident. And certainly we know where that comes from. But when we're talking about hate in schools, I think one of the things that Nora and I really have tried to weave throughout the toolkit is that it doesn't matter if this feels like it's, you know, this incident, whatever it may be, feels like it's not a reflection of your school community. It doesn't matter if only one person saw it or zero people saw it. You erased it really quickly. You know, these are school culture issues, and they're school safety issues, really. And so schools have to address it as a systemic problem no matter what. So that's what I would add on.
Safety issue indeed. I totally agree. I see the parents. Let me get one more question in, and parents, here we come. I certainly agree. Safety issue. I'll just say that when we were talking about the so-called racial disparities with being exacerbated with the shutdown with COVID-19, hate groups are not responsible for that racial disparity. That is collectively individuals classified as white. Not necessarily Richard Spencer, not necessarily white nationalists. That is collectively individuals classified as white. That is what dedication to racism, white supremacy produces by design. And as I said, throughout the known universe, locally, nationally, globally. And I just, in my view, when the focus is white nationalism, it greatly ignores the totality of the problem that produces. It's, for me, it would even be hard to draw the line of demarcation between what is just typical racist behavior and what's going to be isolated to this is white nationalist conduct. But I could be my misinterpretation. You all mentioned Elliot Rodger in the book, and wowee, I perked up greatly. We spent a significant amount of time talking about Elliot Rodger. For folks who do not remember or maybe didn't hear the first time, this is 2014 in California. Elliot Rodger, he killed about 5 to 6 people. He had a lengthy manifesto that was attributed to him that was posted. We discussed sections of the manifesto back in 2014. Lots was said and written about this. I know there's so many shootings, unfortunately, in the United States that sometimes it can just be a blur going from one shooting to the other. But anytime there's a loss of life, I think people should take it seriously and try to evaluate, try to make sense as best they can of what happened, why this happened. And particularly if that loss of life is related to racism, white supremacy with Elliot Rodger, it certainly was. To go back to the question I asked before, I think it's so important. Either Nora, Jessica, are you all familiar with Elliot Rodger, his racial classification?
I don't remember how he identified.
I don't remember how he identified. I think I'm running on the assumption that he's white.
Okay. That was Nora. She said she's running on the assumption that he's white. And Jessica, did you say you remembered or you did not remember?
I mean, I would be speculating. I don't, in my head, he wasn't white, but I don't remember how he identified.
Okay. My memory is not perfect either, so that is allowable. As I said, we talked about this a ton, late physician, third generation physician, and author, Dr. Francis Cress Welsing, who, native of Chicago, she spent hours. She was fascinated by the case of Elliot Rodger for a number of reasons. 2014, you can check the archives. We spent a whole program talking about this shooting incident with Dr. Welsing. I wrote about this incident, and I got to go back and read what I wrote. Whew, it is always great when you can go back and read something that you wrote that's like years old and not feel like you have to crawl and hide somewhere and whatever. You can stand by your work. What I wrote was the manifesto attributed to Elliot Rodger contains the word invisible. I started with Invisible Man from Ralph Ellison. I'm just skipping over that. But the manifesto attributed to Elliot Rodger contains the word invisible 22 times. The Isla Vista massacre has been widely reported, and Rodger's digital fingerprints, videos, and postings have been dissected, redacted, and politicized. feeble victims sob for gun control and again fail to loosen the grip of my cold, dead hand. Charlton Heston. The NRA has a lawsuit in California about closing gun stores. Sorry for the interruption. The most prominent talking point from this tragedy being that Roger was a mentally disturbed misogynist. White-dominated media outlets have framed the murder of two white women and four males, three of which were Asian, as a hate crime against women. In death, as in life, the perception of Elliot Roger remains distorted. Whites refuse to accurately view and interpret these events. This is not an exoneration of Roger's alleged crimes, but a commitment to truth and a special duty to accurately understand any events that involve the loss of life. One of the single most important questions when dealing with the people on the planet dominated by racism, white supremacy is, what is the racial classification of the person? This is directly from the manifesto. So this is no longer Gus T. I'm just reading a few sentences from Mr. Rogers' manifesto, and then I'll get your response. He writes, allegedly, this is all attributed to him, as my fourth grade year approached its end, my little 9-year-old self had another revelation about how the world works. I realized that there were hierarchies, that some people were better than others. Of course, I was subconsciously aware of this in the past, but it was at this time of my life, at 9 years old, that I started to give it a lot of thought and importance. I started to see this at school. At school, there were always the cool kids who seemed to be more admirable than everyone else. The peaceful and innocent environment of childhood, where everyone had an equal footing, was all over. The time of fair play was at its end. Life is a competition and a struggle, and I was slowly starting to realize it. When I became aware of this common social structure at my school, I also started to examine myself and compare myself to these cool kids. I realized with some horror that I wasn't cool at all. I had a dorky hairstyle, I wore plain and uncool clothing, and I was shy and unpopular. I was always described as the shy boy in the past, but I never really thought my shyness would affect me in a negative way until this point. This revelation about the world and about myself really decreased my self-esteem. On top of this was the feeling that I was different because I am of mixed race. I am half white, half Asian, and this made me different from the normal, fully white kids that I was trying to fit in with. I envied the cool kids, and I wanted to be one of them. My first act was to ask my parents to allow me to bleach my hair blonde. I always envied and admired blonde-haired people. They always seemed so much more beautiful. I stopped the quote there. As I said, we spent a lot of time talking about Elliot Roger in 2014. It is in the archive. I did not conclude this was misogyny and someone who went out and did this because they hated women. If you read the entire manifesto, which I did, there's a lot of this, him talking about his frustrations not being accepted as white. There is frustration with women. As you all point out in the report, he did express frustration about so-called interracial relationships, particularly with black males being with white women, but a lot of his frustration seemed very much rooted in the fact that he was not accepted as white. Your response? We start with Jessica on this one.
Yeah, you know, where to start? So I think the first thing I just want to say is that this is not what I would expecting to speak about on the interview, and so I'm happy to share my thoughts, but I wasn't prepared for this particular question. So I would encourage your listeners to also do your own research. It sounds like you have quite a bank of interviews and commentary that they can look to on the show, and there's plenty that's been written out there on the misogyny of Elliot Rogers. I think one term, if folks are looking to advocate themselves, would be to read about the incel movement, of which he was not a part of them, but loosely affiliated, and the things, the comments that you were reading, if you had made line up very closely with incel culture around, you know, not feeling attractive enough, you know, wanting to make sure that women find you attractive, this sort of area and definition of beauty. The listener can read about it and probably even it's pretty distinct stuff. So I don't recommend doing it before bed. But Elliot Rodgers certainly is not alone in these ideas.
Nora, did you want to respond?
I guess what I would add to that is, Elliot Rodgers is, to me, another strong instance of a kid who gave a lot of warning signs, especially in school settings. I think one piece I read about him said as far back as 8 years old, his behavior was kind of catching people as problematic and some described it as disturbing. Where in schools we don't have enough mechanisms in place to provide the mental health and social services that kids need when they are acting out and speaking out and indicating that all is not well. And that goes for someone who is a misogynist, that goes for someone who is self-loathing, that goes for someone who has emerging symptoms of mental illness. So one of the things we advocate for in the toolkit is better staffing of wellness personnel at schools, like social workers, counselors, even librarians, you know, to help kind of keep an eye on what's going on with kids who need help. So I guess when I think about Elliot Rodgers, I think that I'm not so much equipped right this second to argue about what caused him to do what he did as I am to say it was another kid who slipped through the system after giving every sign that he needed help.
This is on page 9 from the toolkit. You all write, when Elliot Rodger killed 7 people in 2014, he left behind a manifesto expressing extreme misogyny, putting women in concentration camps, and racism, hatred of interracial couples. He had been active in misogynist alt-right online communities and was celebrated in those spaces after the murders. Did you all read his manifesto?
I read his manifesto, yeah.
That's Jessica? Nora,
I read parts of it. I haven't read it start to finish.
Okay. And you said you don't feel qualified. That was you, Nora. You don't feel qualified to respond to what motivated
me,
his conduct?
Jessica.
Okay. Nora, same thing?
Yeah. Well, I expected to... go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. Go ahead. Sorry.
I said I didn't feel prepared because it wasn't, you know, I haven't read it super recently, and I expected to come on your program and talk about our toolkit. And so the section where we refer to Elliot Rodgers' manifest, just a sidebar, a small sidebar, talking about the relationship between misogyny and white nationalism. So if we want to sort of tie it back a little bit, I'm happy to talk more, but I don't feel like I'm personally in a place to debate you about the misogyny involved in Elliot Rodgers' manifesto.
Okay. It wasn't a debate. It's just something I'm familiar with this report. And it is mentioned in the toolkit. You all have a reference for it. And I generally feel like it's acceptable to ask any questions about something that someone has written in a published report, especially a report where you have footnotes for Mr. Rodgers' situation. That would seem that there was at least some research to give out these opinions. With that, I'll get to some of the parents.
There absolutely is. I can't let that go. I'm sorry. This is a very well-researched toolkit. It's just that you haven't given us any questions in advance. And the assumption I was under was that we were talking about the toolkit.
Elliot Rodger is in the toolkit. Okay, but Elliot Rodger is mentioned in the toolkit directly. As I said, he is referenced, and I do not ever give out my questions to guests in advance, so this is standard protocol. I will get to some of the folks who dialed in. If you all have questions for Nora Flanagan, Jessica Asi, feel free, *61 for those who are listening. Again, parents, if you have a thought, you have a scenario and you would like input, possible ideas on how to remedy a situation without causing problems, *61. Caller in New Jersey, if you have a question for Jessica, Nora, you should be with us.
Hey, Gus and guests, you know, how everybody doing? I have a question about a scenario and how would it be handled, you know, according to your toolkit. But I have one question. Is this for the female guest who said that her mother was white and her father was Lebanese? Okay. You know, I just have a question. I just filled out the 2020 census, and Egyptian and Lebanese was under the classification of white. Do you have a response to that? Because it confused me.
Yes, it has confused me and many of my, many people that I know who identify as Arab or Arab American for a long time. There have been a lot of movements of folks advocating for there to be a separate classification for Arab folks, and it didn't make it onto this year's census. But feel free to look up the National Arab American Association or the Arab American Association of New York. They both have their websites with resources and all the work they've put into to advocating for a more inclusive census.
Okay. No problem. I won't push any further on that. Okay.
It's a good question. Very frustrating.
Yeah, very good question. That's why it gets kind of confusing, especially when you gave the classification. Okay. With the workbook. So I don't have any children. But I do have a number of young cousins. All right. And I had an 8-year-old cousin. He was basically called trash by a white child. He did it verbatim. He said that black people are trash. When my young cousin confronted the white child, it didn't get physical, but there was a verbal altercation, and when it was brought to the teacher, and my cousin told the teacher what was said, the teacher just basically said, don't worry about it. It's the white child is just ignorant. My cousin, black father, came to school, and he wanted to confront the teacher or just basically, ask. He didn't like how the teacher resolved that situation. In your word, God, what would be the appropriate way to solve the situation that I just described?
I can start on that one. This is Nora. First off, I'm so sorry that happened to your cousin. That's awful, and those are the kind of school experiences that can stick with a kid for life. I'm just so sorry that happened. For starters, going to the teacher doesn't always work. I mean, your cousin saw that. Your cousin did what I would tell my own kid to do, which is go right to an adult that you trust. And that adult broke your cousin's trust, and that's awful to hear as well. As far as what should be done next, this is part of that mantra in the toolkit that we say again and again as far as tell multiple people, because you can almost always count on at least one person you tell minimizing the experience, which is exactly what that teacher did to your cousin. Oh, they didn't mean it that way. That's not a big deal. Well, they're just ignorant. What does that fix? That fixes absolutely nothing. And in a way, it makes it worse because it minimizes and invalidates how your cousin felt and what your cousin experienced. So if I were speaking to your cousin's dad who wants to figure out how to handle it, I would go the next level up to an administrator. And if you get ignored by an administrator, you go to the district or the school board, depending on the size of the school system we're talking about. And that takes commitment, and that takes time, and that takes the availability to do it. But the more people we let minimize these experiences, the more these experiences happen and are normalized, and not just normalized to your cousin, but normalized, and we mentioned this in the toolkit, and I've mentioned this in interviews before, normalized to every other kid who saw it. So now the next kid who has an experience like that is going to know that you shouldn't bother to go to the teacher because nothing's going to happen. So we always recommend going to multiple outlets, a counselor, another trusted adult, a coach, anybody, to just get as many people hearing the experience who might be able to get a better response to address the situation. So, yeah, for starters, tell lots of people. Also, start talking to other parents and see how many other families have encountered a situation like this.
Okay.
That would be my suggestion, too. There's strength in numbers. So, you know, any other stories that you can collect, other parents who had similar experiences, if it's happened to one student, it certainly happened to more than one. And having those other parents as allies, maybe they co-sign a letter with you, maybe they have a joint meeting with you, maybe you take it farther and you have a press conference. But strength in numbers is always a good strategy in my book.
Okay, last question. I'm on the East Coast. I'm from New Jersey. But there's a large Hispanic population. And within that population, loosely they use the word Gus. Can I just refer to the N word, or can I say the whole word?
I never say the N word. Nigger, is that what you're talking about? Like, I don't use N word.
I'm talking about nigger. So they use people who are classified as Hispanic use nigger, and they use it in many terms. I mean, many ways, and they may say it's in a term of endearment. It's used in Hispanic slang. In your world, God, if you were to encounter a non-black, non-white student using the word nigger, what will be the appropriate way to approach that kind of situation if it's used in a school setting?
Jessica, do you mind if I speak on this too? Because this is actually something that has happened at the school where I teach a number of times. So I teach at a school in Chicago that draws from all over the city. So we have every population of Chicago represented in our high school. And most of the time, because Chicago is historically an incredibly segregated city, most of our students have gone to grade school with people who look like them. But then they come to a high school and they're surrounded by everybody. So we run into a lot of these kind of complicated, not so cut and dry situations. And that specifically, the situation you described, we've addressed that at my school multiple times each school year, the last several years. And it isn't one of those situations where you just come crashing down on the Latinx student who used the N-word because it's always been used in their neighborhood and they didn't mean it that way. It's not so simple. What we've had success with at my school in addressing that situation is sitting students down together and facilitating a conversation among students where African-American students can say, yeah, I get that you say this. Like, you said this at grade school, you say this in your neighborhood. Here's how it sounds when we hear it in this building in front of, you know, our black classmates, in front of white classmates, in front of white teachers. Like, it's different now, and here's why. And we've, in that respect, especially me as a white educator, I can't speak to that as effectively as my students of color can. So in that situation, I suggest having adults who, you know, are experienced in facilitating uncomfortable conversations, which, by the way, is training that every school should have to help their staff members facilitate conversations. Let the students take the lead and let them speak to the issue because they can do it better than I can. And it's my job to help them get that done.
Okay. Okay. I have one more question, but if I can't get it in, that's fine.
Let me get some of the other folks and I can swing back.
No problem.
Much obliged, sir. Right. Bay Area Mommy, did you have questions?
Hi, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, hi. Hi. Thank you for taking my call and thank you guys for coming on the program. I know a child that went to a school, Stacy, California. Young lady daycare to preschool, and they didn't have him doing much. He just stood around, literally, kind of like babysitting him. And his parents came in the class. There was an area for the child, for children. And it had child's name right there. And it was more like a timeout area. And so she said, well, what's this? And they said, oh, well, we call it by her name. And it's like John's point. And I go, what does that mean? So I called the back kids when, you know, for the door over there. So I got frustrated. Nothing was done. And she ended up removing them out of the school. But to this day, he may be in junior high now, he's never adapted from being in that setting. Do you think that situations like that, when you're more or less treated as if you're maybe not going to succeed anyway, if that will affect their development later on because of how it was instilled from that age, the developmental part of it, like daycare to preschool? Thank you.
Jessica, I can answer this. I can speak to this a little bit in that just as someone who's been studying education for 25 years, yes, what happens to kids in school settings as young as daycare and preschool will stick with them. And if we don't address the kind of treatment kids are encountering, especially when it's that focused and negative, I mean, I'd like to think we remember some of our best school moments, but the truth is we also remember some of our worst school moments, consciously and unconsciously. And it takes a lot sometimes to fix and counteract some of the bad encounters that students have, especially if it speaks to their identity and how they see themselves and what kind of capabilities they feel like they have. I mean, I'm not an early childhood educator. I'm a high school teacher, but just right off the bat, I would say that, yeah, absolutely, things that kids run into early on in school, especially if it's reinforced along the way in other ways, yeah, that sticks with a kid and it becomes really, really hard to correct. And I'm sorry to hear that.
Me too. I agree with what Nora said, and I am sorry to hear that. I think, you know, we know that racism causes all sorts of unequal outcomes, and so really anything any of us can do, especially as educators, to interrupt that system is, you know, is a responsibility worth undertaking.
Thank you. And that's the only question or statement that I have. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you. Hey, so Gus, I'm holed up in my son's bedroom and it's bedtime. I have to get my kids ready for bed. Is there anything that we can answer in closing or any, I don't know, next steps, or do we want to continue chatting by email?
Can we get one more question from a listener?
Sure, yes. But like I said, I've been really thrilled to participate, but I have to get my kids to bed in a minute.
So our last question from a listener?
Yes, please. Thank you.
Okay. Henry in Chicago.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, hey. Hi, Chicagoan.
Hi, how you doing? This is Jessica, right?
Nora.
I'm here, but you were talking to Nora.
Oh, yeah. I know there's Nora as well. But Jessica, did they say you were from the Beverly area?
No, that's Nora.
That's Nora. Oh, Nora. I'm sorry. My apologies. Okay, Nora. So you are familiar with that area, right?
I am.
Okay. So I grew up in the Morgan Park area, which is right next door. Now, my question is, now since when I was going to high school in the late 80s, early 90s, up until now, there is a particular high school in Mount Greenwood, which is next door, Chicago Agriculture, which a number of black students go to, but a lot of the black students don't live in the area of Mount Greenwood. Now, as I have pointed out in this program, Mount Greenwood is considered what we call a sundown town. And yep. A lot of the students who have to go to that school get constantly harassed if they are not being personally driven to the school, because even with public transportation, I've had a number of friends who went to that school And the only time they don't get harassed is when they're together. But when they're by themselves, you know, they always get harassed by the people in their neighborhood. So this is a scenario where it's not in the school. This is outside of the school. Does your guy have some sort of measure where black children who go to these schools that have to pass through these white hostile neighborhoods can get there safely?
So, first of all, technically, I'm from Morgan Park, east of Western 107th. Hi, Morgan Park. I went to Morgan Park High School for a year. Yes, and let me explain how. We believe, and I think this is stamped all over the toolkit as well, that student safety is the top priority, and that isn't just when students are in the building. Because our students' lives are, and not just even in the commute, we talk a lot about what happens in online spaces. School communities have to be committed to student safety and to protecting our students, specifically in the toolkit from aggressive racism and white nationalism and white nationalist recruitment. But anything that is compromising our students' safety is the concern of the school. And too often, schools may try the defense of, well, that's not our responsibility. We can't control the CTA. It's your students, and they're coming to and from your school, so it is your business, and they should be involved. And I know exactly what you're talking about. We're talking about the 111th Street bus, right?
Yes.
That takes the kids west to Agricultural Sciences High School. And I'm aware of some of the things that have gone on in Mount Greenwood, even over the last few years, like some of the community protests and counter-protests. It's gotten really scary down there. And so for students to be commuting through that just to try to go to high school, I absolutely think the school should be involved in every aspect of student safety, because that's a part of their school life. I mean, kids can't learn if they don't feel safe, and that goes for in the building and it goes on the way to and from.
It's always been scary. Since I was a teenager, my first encounter with somebody from Mount Greenwood was at 9 years old, when I was walking on Western, and, you know, I was being harassed by a couple of white people who were in a truck hollering nigger. So, you know, that's been around for decades.
Yep. Yeah, I wish I could say that, you know, since I grew up there, because it sounds like we're roughly the same age, because I was going to grade school in Beverly Morgan Park, like, late 80s. I wish I could say it's gotten so much better. There are parts of that area that have gotten better, but there are also aspects of it that people still don't want to address. They don't want to address this long history of kids encountering what you're talking about. And a lot of it ends up being dismissed as not our problem to fix, or it's always been that way. And at some point, you know, people have to jump in. There's a really great community organization. I think the Southwest Diversity Initiative or Collaborative, there's a great organization down there that addresses issues like this. I've been to a couple events with them around the toolkit, and they're doing great work around the schools as well. So there's good stuff happening in that area. I think there's great stuff happening in a lot of communities, but there's just so much work to do, and there's so much frustration over these issues not being addressed in the past or, you know, last week.
Okay. Thank you for your response.
Thank you.
Much obliged. Thank you for holding up bedtime for your offspring. We've been chatting it up about the report, Confronting White Nationalism in Our Schools, a toolkit. We had two of the co-authors, Nora Flanagan in Chicago, Jessica Acey in Oregon. Much obliged for hanging out, taking questions from our listeners. Hope things go well. I guess the rest of the school year, we'll have to see how it goes, but hopefully it will end well for the students and all involved. We will be in touch and keep an eye out for future reports from the Western States Center.
Thanks so much. Take care.
Much obliged. Context of white supremacy. I did see other folks who dialed in. Wish we could have got you as well. Bummer. Some folks did wait a little late in the broadcast to get a hand up. If I had seen you a little sooner, I would have, you know, got a hand up. But anywho, if y'all want to share a thought, your experiences, certainly if we have parents, you're always welcome. We'll take a quick commercial break. And then folks, if they did not get a chance to share, if you have any parents or folks who have observations or just want to get their question in that they didn't get a chance to ask, we will make time. Context of white supremacy. We will be right back.
Is racism hurting you? On issues of race, are you unable to speak, think, and act with clarity and confidence? Are you tired of laughing when nothing is funny, smiling when you are not happy, agreeing when you really disagree? CounterRacism.com, you can learn specific strategies and techniques to counter the behaviors of the people who practice racism in all areas of activity. Using words correctly, following counter-racist logic, even counter-racist science projects designed to reveal what racism is, how it works, and how to counter it. The open source code writing format allows you to pick and choose from a variety of counter-racist suggestions so you can produce the code that works for you. Stop by counterracism.com today and help replace racism with justice.
That's counter-racism.com.
Context of white supremacy. First thing I want to say, we are going to get it to the parents, other folks who dialed in, *61, make sure you get a chance to share. But the first thing I want to say, man, anybody who is listening to this program, live or archived, be very clear. It looks like we could be like in shelter in place, social distancing, all of that for a month. Given the severity of all of this on a global scale, this is unprecedented. I've not seen anything like this ever. I don't even know a reference point for something like this in terms of all of these measures and countermeasures. But anybody who says, you know, hey, we have got substantially more important things. You are being an irresponsible broadcaster, having guests on to talk about white supremacy at a time like this. You should be talking about how to make do-it-yourself hand sanitizer, do-it-yourself toilet paper, things to do if the electricity goes out, practical things, you know, in a time of great, washing your hands, like emphasizing that, tips that they said they got in South Korea to use your non-dominant hand when opening doors and that sort of thing, turning on lights. Because you will be more likely, if you're going to touch your face, to use your dominant hand. Maybe that's the main thing that we should be doing. We should be doing that as opposed to talking about, you know, white nationalism in the schools. Anybody who takes that position, let me know, because I did think about that. It might be irresponsible to be broadcasting about white supremacy racism under these conditions. I did think that for a short period of time. And then I heard our president, my president, say Chinese virus again. And here we are. Let's get back on the air. But that might be valid. That is something to consider. And anybody under these conditions, you should be getting constructive information. Like, this is not entertainment time, wasting time. Like, we need to be efficient with time and energy under these conditions. We should be under wartime conditions anyway, because racism, white supremacy is war. But certainly now, I mean, emergency conditions, we shouldn't be wasting time. All of that said, frequently, this is not like an enjoyable occupation, hosting this broadcast. It would be cool, like I hear when people have, like, take some admitted racist Tim Wise, they'll have him, or Jane Elliott, admitted racist, they'll have them on the program, and it'll just be all laughs and giggles. Tell us about white privilege, Jane. Isn't that funny? Oh yeah, tell us about, you know, it'll just be laughs and giggles. the whole time, and they have a great old time, and people just, oh, that was wonderful. That was a wonderful show. Like, it would be grand to do that. Like, it is not enjoyable to be like, oh, that Negro. That with lots of folks who, you know, yes, I've been to the cows and despise that Negro, to have that be the general feeling. But, you know, this is not a popularity contest. We are supposed to be about the business of solving problems, the business of replacing white supremacy with justice. That's it. Couple quick things I did want to make sure that I pointed out. First and foremost, just to be explicit, the problem that I am addressing is white supremacy, racism. Global system dominates the known universe. That's the problem. Addressing so-called white nationalism? Really, anyone, that's specifically what you're talking about, and you acknowledge that there is a system of white supremacy, but you're specifically addressing so-called white nationalism? I would have to give a side eye as to, now, are they really serious about solving this problem? Like, Richard Spencer is not causing racial disparities. Richard Spencer's not even an elected official. School to prison pipeline, that sort of thing, like Stormfront. These folks are not responsible for these problems. Like, this is a small subsection of the army of the white race. Again, the problem is the system of white supremacy, racism, not white nationalism. I get it if they say this is specifically what they're addressing in schools, but I just say again, I mean, I don't know. Is it white nationalism if someone come, if a 15-year-old, if they come to school and they have a MAGA shirt on, is that white nationalism? I don't know. If they come in and they have on a shirt with Andrew Jackson, is that white nationalism? If they quote Thomas Jefferson about the Negro, is that white nat? That's what I mean. Like, where do we draw the line of demarcation between what is typical white supremacist behavior that gives us the everyday result, Chinese racism, racial disparities in Chicago, and all the rest of it, and Richard Spencer, this is white nationalism, the alt-right, Pep the Frog, that sort of thing. Like, that would be major side eye. At least for me, another major side eye, I think it's Stand By Your Work. Now, concede, my memory is not perfect. I am a victim of white supremacy. People have called in and asked me about, hey, Gus, do you remember such and such archive from, you know, such and such date, such and such time, and you were talking to such, and sometimes this has to be, nope, I do not remember that at all. No aspect of it. Sometimes I have to concede that. Like, man, I'm going to have to go back and listen to that. Like, we've had a number of people like, do you remember what you said to such and such? Well, you, nope, not at all. We've been here for 11 years. I do not remember every single thing that, you know, I've said that we've talked about over the last 11 years. I don't remember everything that I've written. I've written a lot over that time period. However, if somebody says, I want to talk to you about this specific report, oh, even if they didn't, if I wrote it, period, I wrote it, I'm going to stand by my work. I wouldn't care if I wrote it in 2009. I just published a report that I authored in 2009, Film Review of Candyman. Stand by your work. I do not accept that. I've heard that a few times before from guests where I asked them a question about something that was in their work and they didn't remember or didn't have the details on it. And, you know, we're kind of like, well, I didn't come here with the expectation that it's on page 23 of the book. Like, what? Like, I mean, what the world? Stand by your work. Like, you should be confident. If you're going to put it down, somebody might ask you about any aspect of what you wrote. It might be the grammar, sentence structure of the report. It might be details, particularly something, if you got footnotes for, like, oh, yeah, you should be ready to roll. Like, with any questions, you take a stance about this. This is not something that's just a footnote. Like, this is in the body of the text. Oh, yeah, you should be ready to, whatever the questions are. And if I can't, if I don't remember, then that's all it is. Like, hey, my bad. Mea culpa, as they say. I didn't remember. I didn't think you were going to ask about that, but my fault. It is in the report. with, you could even put the, never mind, I was going to say the FAIR question. That would be a response, but no. That is an acceptable question to ask. It's in the body of the text. I wrote it. I'll stand by my work. If I don't remember, I don't remember. My fault? Maybe you can ask me about it later after I've had a chance to go back and revisit. I say that because I say consistently, strive for accuracy. I said with emphasis in 2014, Dr. Welsing and I spent 3 hours. I'm going to make sure I post that archive. Dr. Welsing thought that was so important. I called Dr. Welsing at 5 o'clock in the morning Pacific time because I was so intrigued about Elliot Rogers. I sat around and listened to that nonsense for days. That shooting, I think, happened on a Friday in 2014, and it was that Monday. I called Dr. Welsing on a Monday morning in May. I called her, and I waited until 5. I was up, but I waited until 5 o'clock in the morning because I said, I know she'll be up, and I'll be able to call her. She was awake, and I called her, and we talked about this for hours. In fact, Dr. Welsing was so intrigued about it, I didn't even ask her to do a program. Dr. Welsing said, you should have me on your program to talk about this. She was so fascinated because this fella, Elliot Rodger, not only did he have one white parent and one non-white parent, and he went out and killed all these people, mostly males. He went out and killed all these people and then had a manifesto attributed to him where he said explicitly what I just read, his frustrations with not being classified as white. In addition to all of that, his dad is a filmmaker who worked on The Hunger Games. You know, that multi-billion dollar franchise where they made all those movies? His dad, Elliot Rodger, worked on that film. When I told that to Dr. Welsing, she said, so you mean this non-white person with a white parent who went out and killed all these people and wrote about being frustrated about not being classified as white, he went out and killed, and he killed college students, so he went out and killed all these young people, and his white father made a film. What's The Hunger Games about? If I had to put it in one sentence, what I said to Dr. Welsing, I said, it's about killing children, hunting and killing children. Isn't that The Hunger Games book, movie? Rue, remember Rue? May the odds be ever in your favor. That's what his dad was on the film for. And she said, so his dad makes a movie about hunting and killing children. His non-white son, frustrated about not being classified as white, not accepted by white women, goes out and kills a bunch of young people, college students. Wow. It's in the archives. We spent 2 hours talking about that case. She thought it was so fat. It revealed so much about the system of racism. We went through and read deconstructed bits of his manifesto and what have you. I went back and reread what I wrote today. I remember we talked about that. I remember it was a lot of people. It was other non-white people who came and said, oh, no, this is a misogynist. He hates women. I just said again, most of the people that he killed were Asian males. How is this misogyny when most of the victims are non-white people? How is this misogyny even when you have a non-white person who is starting at the very beginning of a lengthy manifesto? What I read, the cool kids, the white kids, the blonde kids. Mom, can I dye my hair blonde? Either we have a system of racism, white supremacy, or we do not. That is at the root of everything. We can't piecemeal it and chop it apart and talk about this little bit here and that sort of thing and keep pussyfooting it and bias and prejudice and discrimination and white privilege. No. What does it mean to be white? And I'll close with that cowbell rings for a reason. It's been there for 10 years. The cowbell debuted in 2010. It's there for a reason. Puff, she asked the question some years ago. We were talking about Michelle Alexander. Haven't even read her book yet. That's probably coming in the book club very soon. Oh, we were talking about Michelle Alexander, and I said, every time I think of her, cowbell. She said, why is that? Why is that important, a person who has a white parent? I'll rest there. The number again is 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61. If you would like to participate, I will nab the folks that we missed totally. See if they have any questions. questions. Again, if any folks, if we are being irresponsible, we should be talking about, you know, what is happening, important things, plans for sheltering in place, what we should be purchasing, goods that we need to make sure that we have stocked, do-it-yourself hand sanitizer. Anybody who thinks that we are being irresponsible with the focus of the context of white supremacy, make sure that you speak up loud and clear. Make sure, in fact, we should hear from those folks first. But let's see, people that we missed totally. Let's see, our caller 9516, 9516.
Hello, can you hear me?
Crystal.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am, we can hear you.
Okay. I was just wondering, you had it with two guests. Do they live together or something? Why did both of them have to get off the phone at the same time? Could the other one could have stayed and answered questions too? Did I miss something?
I guess that could have been possible. I think, you know, sometimes people are not interested in talking that long. It was a third party who kind of facilitated the broadcast happening. And he had asked when I confirmed that we were doing the broadcast, he had asked later. I just didn't see it until we were about to go live how long the program was going to be. And I was going to respond. And I was like, man, I don't really know, because if it's going to be multiple people, like, it will take longer. So I'm not sure. So I wasn't sure. I didn't even know like what the adequate response to that question would be. But yeah, one is in Oregon, one is in Illinois. Certainly, you know, we're under quarantine. So like, hey, it's not like we got, you know, the mall and movies and all the rest, to go. But yeah. Yeah. Good question.
Okay. Oh well, the question that I wanted to ask them is that so for the upcoming election, so they having a question on there about MPS receiving more money to exceed the limit. So they have a limit on how much the Milwaukee Public Schools can get. So they having a question on the ballot of do we agree or disagree with increasing that limit? And I was going to ask them, do they think that increasing the limit is it going to help, you know, non-white people, or is it going to just continue, you know, the system as it is? Like, do they think are things like that really worth it to be putting more money into a system that's already messed up, as opposed to do they think it would help? That was the question I was
going to
ask.
I'm not sure. You said MPS, that's Milwaukee? Is that the school system, Milwaukee?
I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm from Milwaukee. So gotcha. Milwaukee Public Schools, they have this question on the ballot that's coming up in the election. So that's the thing that I thought about in my head. Like, how is exceeding this limit going to help, you know, non-white children that mostly go to Milwaukee public schools. Mm-hmm. And I was just thinking it's probably just going to help to, you know, increase what's already going on. I just wanted their opinions on it.
I see. I suspect your thinking is probably correct. About the if they go over the limit to spend more on the public schools there in Milwaukee. I'd say that, number one, just because the context, this is the land of Jeffrey Dahmer, who was stalking non-white males almost exclusively for a long time. And that was part of why he was successful. But Milwaukee, I mean, they lock up more black males than almost anywhere in the universe in Wisconsin. So, I mean, it's not like this is an environment that is friendly to the Negro at all. So, Robin, Wisconsin, longtime listener. He had to migrate, move to San Diego, was so thankful to get away, escape, as they say. But yeah, I think there are lots of examples of white supremacists doing incorrect things in the schools or elsewhere. And then they get more money. That doesn't mean that they stop practicing racism. That doesn't mean that, oh, these are some of the resources that weren't available to you. Now we have more money. We can make them available to you. Sometimes it just means, oh, well, I'll get a raise. Yay. And we can practice even more racism. Like, they've done that. So, yeah, that I would have been curious to hear their thoughts. Milwaukee's not that far from Chicago, so I suspect Nora could have, she might, you know, be knowledgeable about that. She could have maybe given some insight. But yeah, I suspect you are correct. There is one slight point I did want to get in. I always say strive for accuracy. Strive for accuracy. When I made that point about the Oregon school system in comparison to what's happening in Chicago and Portland specifically, Jessica Acey, she is at a private school. That is hugely important. Private schools are going to have enormous resources, generally speaking, in comparison to public schools. Totally correct. I strongly suspect, I'm not an expert, I need to do my homework. In fact, I need to go to Portland and do some time hanging out. I strongly suspect the Portland school systems are better than what they have in Illinois. I strongly suspect that. If I remember correctly, she said that they spend more money, but they get bad results. If I'm understanding that correctly, this could be, you know, laziness, whatever it is, out in Portland. But the times that I have been through Portland, I do not remember any slums or areas like Chicago where I felt like, oh, Lord, I need to run to hurry up and get the hell out of here. Like, there are multiple spots in Chicago, much less Bubbly Creek. Like, I didn't even see that, but they have multiple spots like that in Chicago. I don't think they have places like that in Portland, which would lend me to believe that they were. Whitelandia, does anything about that to you suggest that, yeah, they have some really terrible schools here? Like I said, I'm super ignorant. I will do more research. If we have any listeners who are in the Oregon area who have some familiarity with the Oregon public school system, that would be grand. But that'll be my research project. That's too close for me to be ignorant about. Let's see. I'm trying to get the folks that we missed totally first and then move forward. I'll get our caller in Florida, since I did appropriate his term. He can make sure, let me know if I used it incorrectly or any other observations. Racial focal pointing. I used it because I think it's important. They spent this whole time, wrote this report. They're talking about white nationalism and Richard Spencer and alt-right and all the rest of it. I'm talking about the system of white supremacy racism. Richard Spencer is not responsible for the Milwaukee public school systems not taking care of black students, unless I missed something. Just making sure I'm using the term correctly, racial focal pointing, and giving credit. And then if you have any other observations, caller in Florida.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, listeners and callers. Gus, definitely that was correct, definitely. And I suspect that they, with them using the term white nationalism, I do agree that that's another attempt at doing that. So, you know, I'm glad that you mentioned that, especially with, I know there's a term that people have heard, the, you know, the mother is the first teacher of the child, I think. So when I'm thinking of white teachers, I think I only know the statistics on it. Is most of them white women, Gus, or most of the teachers? I think you spoke on this before.
Absolutely. It's approximately 70%. Yes, sir.
See, now, hey, that's another one right there. See, so they have a tremendous influence on just non-white children, white children, definitely. So how, you know, when they're speaking about misogyny and saying things are gender-based, and incels and stuff like that, like, well, where's the participation of the white woman? Like, they're definitely assisting with this system of white supremacy. So that's definitely trying to find a way to, oh, well, we'll just ostracize white female participation and just keep it on these young white male children coming up, and they're, I guess, becoming susceptible to this type of material, so-called white nationalism, because that is not accurate. I agree with that accuracy, because not to put it on sports, but you know, when Floyd Mayweather fought Conor McGregor, everybody was waving the Irish flag. So that's a whole different other nation. And then people look at the white person in Russia. I forgot what his name is. The president over there.
Putin?
People pretty much, yes. Yeah, yes, sir. And Benjamin Netanyahu and all of these people, Boris Johnson, this is all over the world, you know. and they don't have that kind of viewpoint of them, at least when I see reports in the media. So it's definitely white supremacy worldwide, and that's definitely trying to give a narrow, fragmented viewpoint of how we're supposed to be processing, approaching and addressing this issue. And I agree with the cowbell. Thank you. That's all I have for now.
Indeed. Indeed. It has been there for a reason. Let's see. Other folks, I'm just trying to get the people that we missed totally, and then if any other folks have questions or observations, you should too. Retired firefighter in Florida should be with us as well.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to everybody. Accuracy. There was a lack thereof. I would say with the person who identified themselves as white, it probably was on purpose. Although both ladies, including the other lady who attempted to make us to believe that she was considered to be not white, I'm still in doubt. Still a lot of unclear things as far as on their part with the interview in itself. Just like you mentioned before, that's what I would have asked. I would have asked in more detail on something that is called white nationalism. And also the question, do white people have to be recruited into some organization called white nationalism in order to practice racism, white supremacy? Isn't the system of racism, white supremacy in itself is white nationalism, one and the same? And they did not, and I think it was imperative that they did explain that. That could have taken up the entire 3 hours of your normal programs, as far as I'm concerned. To your question about why are we talking about racism, white supremacy, as opposed to the canoris virus? Well, when I think about the long lines of white people who are buying guns, and buying guns as we're speaking right now, and ammunition for their guns, I would say what you're doing, what we're doing right now, is relevant still. You do not have to recruit a white person. By the time a white person even reaches the quote-unquote public school or private school environment, I'm talking about somewhere around 5.5, 6 years old, they already are in the realm of being perfectionists as racist. A white person, by the time they're 6 years old, know that the pretty doll is the white doll, the ugly doll is the black doll. They already know that. Before they even reach the first grade, they already know that. So they don't have to be, I'm not sure on what they mean by recruited, but they don't have to be recruited for anything. We're on a global system of racism, white supremacy. As the program was going on, I attempted to look up in Mr. Fuller's word guide, white nationalism. He didn't have the two words directly connected, but he did have the word separately, nationalism, and he had, under W, he had white nation. And it's relevant to what I've been talking about as far as what they were, that they did not do, which is thoroughly clarify. I heard one of the guests mention something about the difference is it's political. Well, explain that. You know, and those are some of my thoughts and like I said, questions that I would have asked. As far as those that's concerned, clarity.
precision. Precision, clarity. I love it. Do you have to be recruited? Excellent question. Excellent question. Yeah. Strive for precision, exactness when talking about racism, white supremacy. That, in my opinion, is a major strategy for minimizing confusion. And that is a major counter, one of the most effective counters for people that are trying to deceive you. Someone who is trying to deceive you, they are going to want things to be kind of vague. In fact, Nora Flanagan, the white woman who was with us, she did an interview where she classified as a vague expert on racism, white supremacy. She didn't use the language white supremacy, racism, but that's what they were talking about, white nationalism, whatever you want to phrase it, but a vague expert.
Last but not least, Gus, the only thing that I got from their discussion on what it would do, it would make younger white people more sophisticated in their means of practicing racism, which is similar to the results, I think, of what Jane Elliott's program would do and is doing for white people, make them much more sophisticated in their practice of racism. You know, because they are that's the results of purposely or unpurposely unclear or very vague about what you're doing. You're gonna make that group much more sophisticated. And I'll say, oh, okay, well, you got me on that one, Jane. I guess I'm not gonna do that anymore. I'll just find another way to accomplish the same task, which is the practice of racism, white supremacy. That's it.
Much obliged, retired firefighting. They have a little, I don't know what you call them, snippets, right? So they give suggestions, as they said, suggestions for dealing with different scenarios throughout the text. And they have, they're called successes, right? In some of these examples. So they'll give like an example that happened and then they'll give a success story. So this is one. This is on page 14. But there are lots of these throughout the book. So success story. A swastika was found carved onto a library chair with no way of knowing who had done it. The administration removed it immediately and the school's newly formed culture and climate team discussed the incident and brainstormed ways to check in with students who knew it had happened and to be more vigilant about public spaces. The school also implemented an anonymous reporting system to encourage students to come forward with concerns. Now, as someone who does not often use the word success as applied to matters of racism, white supremacy, I do not classify this as a success. To retired firefighters' point, this could be, let's be more sophisticated about how we practice white supremacy. You don't bring your swastika sheets out in public. You don't carve swastikas into the wall. You can practice racism, white supremacy, and mistreat all the niggers and wear a nice pair of khakis, a button-down shirt, be pleasant, mannerous, courteous, get a whole lot done. Let's do it that way. Look at all that we've accomplished. What are you doing? You don't have to do it that way. We're slick. It's 2020. Look like a Neanderthal. Come on, get with it. That, to me, you know, sounds like a lot of what happens in these different matter. Let me give me one more. Let me give you one more success. Let's see. Is this a good one? Let's see. Okay, I'll give you, it's two on this page. Let me see if I can give you the better one. I'll give you the better one. A student used a recognized hate symbol as her avatar on a classroom discussion page. Concerned students emailed the teacher about it. The teacher met with the student outside of class and she insisted she didn't know the image carried racist connotations. She could have been lying. I appreciate that they could have been lying. The teacher shared evidence with her from reputable sources, and they agreed that she would remove the avatar out of respect for her classmates. Again, to me, that's not a success. Like, we would have to find a better word. Like, this is an example of a constructive way of handling this situation. Like, I wouldn't exactly say that's a success. This could be a young racist who lied and did know what this avatar meant and was posting it deliberately as an act of white supremacy. And then after going through this whole ritual, oh, I didn't know, I was ignorant. You know, I'm just a dumb little white girl. I didn't know. Oh, okay. I'll take it down. Gotcha. I'll just wait and call them niggers when we get home. Got it. No problem. That's, you know, and it, for us to be in a system of white supremacy that dominates the known universe, they agreed on that. It would seem like that probably happens more often than not. I could be wrong. Let's see. Other folks that, oh, ho, ho, ho. Before we move on, speaking of little white girls, man, I reread the Elliot Rogers post. Like I said, it is nice. Stand by you, because I didn't remember what I wrote either. This is from 2014, so I didn't remember 6 years ago. But man, going back to reread directly from the manifesto attributed to Elliot Rogers, he said, it's been my life struggle to get a beautiful white girl. You're not going to tell me, that, oh yeah, this is a misogynist. This is someone who just absolutely hates. No, no. This is someone who is acknowledging. And then he had all these posts where he was talking bad about black guys who were with white women. Mad, envious, no good niggers. How are you going to be with a white woman? Ugh, you ape. And he said that he was using language exactly like that. They quoted him in a number of quoted him using that language and calling him a misogynist, as opposed to he is a self-hating victim of white supremacy with a white parent. Other folks who dialed in. Let's see. Let me get everybody. MIDC. Commentary questions. You should be with us.
Yes, sir. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Greetings.
Yes, sir. Greetings and greetings to everyone. I was going to ask a few questions to the host. One of the questions, well, my main question, as usual, is this a good time to talk about white people leaving America, or in the context of her her booklet or her her suggestion booklet, is there a way to introduce the conversation of white people leaving America and maybe also leaving all the other places that they've invaded? Is that something that's acceptable or that maybe they could work on putting in the booklet, and how would they address that situation? Something that happened to me while I was in college. I don't know how they would suggest me handle this particular situation, but while I was in college, and music therapy class, I was taking a music therapy course, and my teacher, a white woman, was talking about her children. You know, it's a mostly white class. And she was talking about her children and how she was raising her children. She said she taught her child brown. Ew. And, like, that's what she taught her child, is the association with brown is ew. That's what, you know, that's what she says to that color. And then, so, you know, what would her suggestion be? How should I have handled that? And then the last question I would ask is, how would a black student, handle white people saying that they're American, and the black student is saying that, no, you're not the American, I'm the American, and you're the invader? But how would you deal with that? Those are my questions.
Let's see. Much obliged, Imhan DC. Would have been grand to hear. Actually, I think the first question, they probably could have taken that one pretty easily, because I think they had something in their toolkit about having positive representations. I think they used language of, like, they might have used people of color. They did say non-white people, I think, once or twice in it as well, but you heard people of color in the definition for white supremacy, their definition of white supremacy. But I suspect they would have said having constructive, positive images of brown people, either from television or wherever, have posters up, because they have that in the toolkit, have posters up of non-white people, brown people, so you can go and point at them and say, oh, now is this person ill, and talk about what they did. And even food, since it's just the color in general, which is very common, to have foods. Oh, this is, you know, chocolate ice cream. That's brown. Is that ill? Oh, okay. And go do, you know, things like that to see if you can change that association. But that is, yes. The other school to prison pipeline. We got a jumpsuit for you, young lad. Say that again. That's the response. A little hyperbole, but yeah, I'm not sure how they would have responded to that one. That would have been curious to hear. Let's see. The caller at 8032, much obliged, Imhan DC, 8032, you should be with us. If you had observations, thoughts, please let us know if you think we are wasting time. We should be talking about, you know, significant things related to protecting ourselves from the Chinese virus.
Good evening, everyone.
Greetings.
Thank you very much for taking my call, Gus. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Sounds like non-Clemson grad.
You know, I look at this toolkit. I think the toolkit that both Nora and Jessica that they had was an addition to frustration that we experience. I thought from my notes about the a culture climate team, report to multiple people. Well, I look at this as a situation such as my son. He's 40 now, and I'm 61. But anyway, I had nothing but trouble in the school system, and I can see that it really relates to what Mr. Fuller talked about in the nine areas being economics and education, the first two. Well, it interrupted my economics, in other words, trying to make a living for the family, by having to deal with his education and the trouble that he got into. And his troubles that he got into was the result of the teachers, starting from elementary all the way up through middle school and high school. And I can say I had teams and reported to every person that thought I could. I still remember the teacher, science teacher, Mr. Engelmeyer. He gave my son so much trouble in school, but I kept telling him, my son, talking to him about what you said, teach your children about racism and white supremacy. Well, this is what I did. And I'm telling you, the system, it works against all the parents with the children in that school system. And I agree with Carter G. Woodson about the miseducation of the Negro. So I really enjoy the show. I have many different notes. And one that I can say that I believe that the system is designed to get worse. And I really enjoyed that other gentleman from Florida when he coined the term racial focal pointing. And I look at that as being a laser tip to racism and white supremacy. And I another point that I had here is white supremacy is the system itself, and the white supremacists, those are the disagreeable ones with trying to straighten things out. It's the vocal mouthpiece, the visible fighting squad, if you would, the ones who show up and show out, and they want the cameras to come out and to bring the attention to them. And the white nationalists are the agreeable ones. Yeah, we need to fix the problem. We need to fix the problem. And I think that's what the toolkit is. The toolkit, to me, equals frustration, more frustration. That's why, in my opinion, they were able just to spend an hour, and they need to go, and the son needs to go to bed. But we still have this issue of these nine areas that we're dealing with. I'll mute my microphone.
Much obliged, much obliged. Great point, great point. Again, most of us are, you know, shelter in place. Good president said, I know here in Washington State, we've been sheltered for a week now, I guess 8 days, a little slightly over a week, except for essentials. Although here, I'm not really sure how that's enforced. It's not like they have tanks on the ground or anything like that, at least not yet. I did see that they were mobilizing the National Guard to move to Seattle specifically in Washington State, but I have not seen any military forces. I haven't been out since Saturday, but I was out Saturday and Friday, and I didn't see any military presence. I didn't see any more enforcement officials than I normally would. Yeah, I didn't see any state troopers in odd places. I know people had talked about that. So there wasn't, I didn't see any mechanism to like shoot people back in the houses. I know that has been happening aggressively in some parts of the world. And they've been talking about that in, I think they've been calling the police like they were snitching. That was the language they were using. They had a snitch hotline like in Florida. Like if you see people violating the stay indoors quarantine, I don't know if it's, you know, if there's suspicion that they have symptoms or the virus and they're going out, or if it's, you know, just people are, you know, congregating or whatever it is, but like they have snitch hotlines for people that are not doing the correct thing in relation to all this. So yeah, it is a lot to, that's why I said like, man, it might be irresponsible. Like maybe we should be talking about it. The one thing I would say in this type of environment, regardless of what you think about the virus, if you think that's legitimate or not, that is totally irrelevant to this point. Although I do think you should take that seriously, take things seriously that white people are taking seriously. That said, this sort of environment where you have increased gun sales, I said that earlier, even though it wasn't related to what we were talking about. The NRA did file a lawsuit in California because they said, hey, you're closing up the gun stores. We need our guns. Got niggers on the loose. Rodney King. Oh, he died. But got more niggers. And they say, yeah, they filed a lawsuit. This sort of environment, it's been tons of reports. I see them every day in all kinds of states talking about rampant gun sales, lines around the corner, not for toilet paper, but for guns. That sort of environment where you have lots of white people who are anxious, stressed, don't know if their business is going to be able to reopen soon and all the rest of it, cooped up in the house, tons of ammunition. You do not want to be reckless in that sort of environment. That's what I would have to say. Be very clear about that. I don't, it's not too many places to go, but I would be really strategic about being out in public space in this sort of environment. I was thinking about going to the grocery store after this is over, but I said, you know what? It will be dark by then. It's not dark now. It's West Coast, so it's 7:21. It's not even 7:30 out here, but it is getting dark. By the time we're done with all this, it'll probably be dark. I'm not sure how I feel about venturing out with lots of heavily armed whites who are stressed and anxious. And any excuse does to mistreat a black person anyway, under these circumstances. Oh, he coughed on me. That too, like that's a crime now. I've seen that reported repeatedly where somebody coughed on someone and they got arrested. That is a criminal offense now. That is not the type of environment that I want to be outside in. Like, I mean, you could sneeze accidentally and, oh, the nigger sneezed on me, coughed on me. And yes. Take all that seriously. I would not advocate being outside recklessly. That's what I would say about this environment. Anyway, any other thoughts folks have on the guests for tonight's program? I think we got everybody that didn't get an opportunity to ask a question. My apologies. Well, they left. That was on them. They left early. Any other folks have questions?
Yeah, Josh,
yes, sir. Call
yeah,
New
Josh,
Jersey.
If I can.
Yes, sir.
The suggestion that they gave when my 8-year-old cousin who was called with an earshot, white young race soldier said that black people are trash, and you know, she basically said, you know, go up the hierarchy of educators, from teacher to principal, maybe superintendent. My cousin did do that, you know, and the issue really wasn't resolved, so I really wasn't satisfied with that response to my question or their suggestion. And when you're basically dealing with a situation where, you know, when you have a racist hierarchy from teacher, principal, to superintendent,
in my high school, Black History Month had a very, very, very great history teacher. His name was Mr. Harden. So successful that people would skip lunch just to sit in on his history class. He made a history tribute, and he put a book by the name, I think the book was called The Black Holocaust. Not only did the Jewish, white Jewish students and faculty had an issue with that book being on display. Later on in the school year, they got rid of it. So when she made the suggestion to, you know, go to maybe the principal, superintendent, you know, what will be the remedy if the whole school system is practices racism, white supremacy? So with that day, I wasn't satisfied. The question that I asked, it just confused me when I despise the term person of color, because it can be very deceiving, and especially when I looked at the census and it said that Egyptian and Lebanese is classified as white. You know, so Lebanese is an ethnicity, but her race is white. I would love to see phenotypically what she looked like. I'm trusting that she can pass in any circle as white. So that was just some of the things. And that particular female that I'm speaking about is very defensive, and because if we're trying to solve the system of racism, it just showed how not serious the guest was. And I'm speaking for the quote-unquote woman of color. That's all I got.
Much obliged, sir. I think it's quite obvious that the people who are serious on the planet right now are the people who practice racism, white supremacy. They are serious. That is what is dominating the known universe. The people who are about replacing white supremacy with justice have not shown that we are as serious or scientifically capable of getting it done at this point. That can't change. Racists would not be doing all the interference and Chinese virus and all the rest if that could not be changed. So, yeah. Still learning, continue to work. We will solve the problem. Other folks have comment. I was thinking the same thing, though, about picture. Like, so, yes. Are you, if we were talking about, like, President Obama, are you lighter than him or darker than him? Like, I'd be very curious. Is this someone who, if they wanted to, could they be accepted as white? Very curious. Very curious about that. Absolutely. Again, there's a reason for the cowbell. Man, other folks who dialed, I think, like I said, I think we got everybody who didn't get a chance to ask a question. So any other folks have observations, questions?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you. Just quick. I wasn't satisfied with my answer as well. And I am so glad that she came from around an area that I grew up with, and she knows the problem that black children at that particular school that I referenced was having. Like I said, that was happening when I was going to high school. And this included actually black girls who were going to that school. So I don't know where the misogyny comes from, because both black boys and black girls were being harassed going to that school. Because of the neighborhood that school is in. Like I said, it's a sundown town. And, even though the system of white supremacy is global, there is a local level. And I was wondering, since, you know, they were, attacking or not attacking, but I would probably say trying to deal with this issue, what have they done on their level? Because obviously, you know, we get all this, you know, grandstanding and, you know, you need to do this and do that. What have you done to solve the problem locally in your area? So
So she was very familiar with the problem. And I like to know, like, because she said there are some areas in Mount Greenwood that are great. I like to know what those areas are, because I don't know any square block of that area what I feel is safe. If I ever have to drive past Mount Greenwood, you know, I would make sure that I would stop nowhere. So I'm just, you know, curious on what areas that she thought was getting better or getting great. So unfortunately, she hasn't solved the issue of, white terrorism by a group of people who I don't think are considered white nationalists. If anybody knows Mount Greenwood, a bunch of race soldiers live there. I mean, if you want to consider them white nationalists, but race soldiers live in that area. So basically, that's all I had on my mind.
Much obliged. Yeah, she did seem very familiar with the area that you were talking about. Problem still there. I was going to ask her if we had more time. I was going to ask her about the response to Mayor Lightfoot closing down the parks. That was not, you know, related to the toolkit, but I was just curious, because that's not white nat, or is it? Like, that response, is it? If they come out, oh no, this nigger is not going to tell us, we can't go. Now, is that white nationalism, or is that just typical white behavior? Retired firefighter?
Yes, and another huge unclarified subject that they had included was this, and I don't use the word that much, misogyny. What females were these white male racists were mistreating because they're females? Non-white females are not mistreated because they're females. They're mistreated because they're not white. So, it wasn't a whole lot of clarity with that. The only thing I can see is that white females are getting what will want more than just reaping the benefits from the global system of race and white supremacy. They want to be managers also. They want to be the takers and the managers of the system of race and white supremacy on a quote unquote equal basis with white males, which they probably already are as it is. But one thing I've been noticing more so than anything, from the idea of, well, maybe the white women want to become head football coaches with a championship level team where all of the players are black males. I see that burgeoning around this part of the world with the advent of white females being coaches in sports where most of the players, if not all, are black males on the professional level. I can see that taking place in the near future with the NBA or the NFL. You know, it's happening with the NFL as we speak, as far as that's concerned. You know, maybe that's what it is. I'm not sure, but although there's evidence towards it. But, I mean, recklessly inaccurate, and whereas I suspect, especially with the female who readily admitted that she was a white woman, that she was definitely practicing the system of racial white supremacy by having that a part of her program in itself. Thank you.
Much obliged. I'm just going back to their definition of white supremacy. And that's why I said it's confusion, because they kept, when I was pointing out, this is not an accurate definition of white supremacy, in my opinion. And they even said, oh, we have the same definition of white supremacy. And I say, no, we don't. It's not the same at all. Like, your definition is a system designed to maintain control over people of color and the rights of all women. Now, that's the same thing I've said before in these. If people of color, unless you're saying that only people of color are males, unless that's what you're saying, if that's what you're saying, fine. But if people of color, if that's all males and females, then what you need to say is a system designed to maintain control over people of color and the rights of white women. That's what would make this make, or at least, all right, now I know what you're saying. And then I can say, no, I don't agree with that. I do not think that's accurate at all. I do not think the system of white supremacy is about, quote unquote, controlling the rights of white women. And the rights to do what? You would even have to give me a little bit of rights to do what exactly?
Right.
That I think right. Mr. Fuller talked about that before, and being cautious about that word right. Like, that was like, this is not the same as my definition at all. At all. That would even be interesting to go back to listen to that portion. But I mean, yeah, like that definition is so vague, inaccurate. And I feel like for most people, they were, and again, she's an English professor. She is an English professor. That should not be lost. She teaches her students rhetoric. I was going to ask her about that. Anytime you talk
to a white person,
you talk to a white person and they are an English professor. They write. They have some skill with language. That's a part of their profession. So they spend a lot of time refining their use of words. Oh, man. They are going to be super. That is the tool that, I mean, literally the metaphor, the bricks and mortar, the foundational components of this system. Words. Words. It's a reason they have crossword puzzles and white people are about reading. I posted they were doing all these things to make ebooks available for free and libraries here so people can read while they're here and not be deprived of all the yumminess at the library. Words are important. They understand the use of words and definitions like that. That definition, right? That it is so early in the report. That was enough right there. You're saying white nationalism, and then this is the definition that you use for white supremacy, which most of the time they don't even give a definition, but this is the definition that you come with. That lets me know a lot about people talking about how serious you are about solving this problem. That lets me know a lot. Anything else? Folks need to get in.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I looked at some more of my notes, and I looked at what you were brought up about this Elliot Rogers, this 22-year-old, and I pulled up his manifesto. He has a long manifesto, and it was really interesting that neither one of them had ever knew who he was. They never heard of him, and they have a toolkit designed to fix it. And who I know very well that has a lot of experience with toolkits is the retired firefighter. They had every tool you could imagine to fix everything that they needed on scene. But these folks here, Nora and Jessica, they didn't have a knowledge of who this person was. They should have been studying him the same way that that we studied the Dolphin Cove fire in 2002 as to what happened when firefighters were injured. How do you not let that happen again? So how could they not let this another young man kill 5 and 6 and 7 people again, too? So I say, though, that their toolkit is a toolkit to confuse and to frustrate, to make us think that they're wanting to fix something when that's never their intention, is to fix it. They like it the way it is. I'm with my line.
Much obliged, sir. I'll get not non-Clemson grad, but much obliged, sir, for sharing. I think that case is so important. I'm going to make sure that I post when Dr. Welsing. We talked about that for hours, literally, Dr. Welsing and I. She was fascinated with that. For him to carry that out, die in the process, be killed in the process, and his father worked on the Hunger Games. What's that about? Killing children. Let's see. Our caller in Canada, do you have commentary to share, sir?
Well, I just found it interesting that the young lady, Jessica, who says that she identifies herself as non-white, I sent you a picture of her in the Why Racism email. You could see what she looks like. As from what I see, she's clearly someone that can pass for white. So that was just my comment. Thank you.
Much obliged, sir. Much obliged. Yes, absolutely. If this image is the person that we spoke with tonight, absolutely. This is someone that I think could be accepted as white. I think they could be accepted as white. And I do say, this is my personal code. It is United Independence. So this is, you know, do whatever you want to. I have personally, like, people that I could see, talk to people who identified as not white. Sometimes they would concede that at times, if they don't say anything, they can be accepted as a white person if they want to. And I've sometimes had to ask questions about what that means. Often that'll be related to racism. People will say racist things or practice racism and just assume that you're white, you're racist. You should be, you know, niggers, right? And if they don't say anything, then, hey, they assume that you're white and let's roll, you know, let's roll. Those individuals, the position that I take personally is you're not going to fool me. If you admit that, or if I think that that's the case, whether you admit it or not, you're not going to fool me. If anything about your conduct suggests, wait a minute, this person is behaving like they could maybe be accepted as white, or they are trying to be accepted as white, or anything like that, any point where I have any suspicion at all, and I think that this is someone who could be accepted as white, you just become a suspected racist. I don't care if you do say that you're not white, because racists do that sometimes. They will cause confusion. If I think you're able, truthfully, I'm not lying. This is not like a victim. This is not Lil Wayne has got on my nerves today, and I'm looking at him squint eyes. And, you know, I think he could. This person, I actually believe, could be accepted as white, like legitimate. Like if they wanted to, they could go to the Department of Licensing and get, wham, white stamped on their DMV. White stamped on their birth certificate, all of that. They could do that if they wanted to. If I think that's the case and I have any suspicion about this person's conduct at all, you just get moved to suspected racist until proven otherwise or until the system exists. That's just my personal code. I'm not suggesting that for anybody else, but confusion is a part of how this system works. Any other folks' comments?
Matt Barrett.
Henry in Chicago.
Since this big thing of misogyny, I would have loved to know what their opinion was on Susan B. Anthony, race soldier who was a feminist in the feminist movement. And also, too, I'm surprised, and I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but both of these women have education backgrounds. And I know in the process of, say, like a dissertation capstone or a thesis, you know, major universities, you know, you get critiqued on these by a board. And one of the things, I know with my thesis, they criticize, they kind of like ask questions about, okay, reference here, you know, tell me about such and such and such and such. And it's like, I'm surprised they, you know, coming from education backgrounds, that they weren't prepared to defend, you know, their work, like you said, and to defend their sources, because that's another thing. You have to defend your sources, you know, to make your, make the paper legitimate. So I'm surprised they didn't know that. So that's all I had.
Much obliged, sir. Like I said, my memory is not the best, so, you know, I did not remember every aspect of Elliot Rogers' report. I don't remember every program that we have done, but if someone does call me and let me know in advance they want to talk about a specific report or program, oh yeah, let's rock and roll. And any questions you want to ask about that, let's hear it. And if I, you know, can't respond or don't remember, then the best I should be saying is, my fault. I will do better. Stand by my work. I did write it. I should be ready to explain. Draftomania, did you have commentary? You should be with us. Draftomania.
Hi, Jess. I thought that they were doing a lot of deflection, like kind of not really answering the question. And the lady that, you know, she seems to get a little annoyed when you ask her about the report. Like you just said, the report that they had this report in the book. a photography guy that shot, you know, shot up all the people. But then when you asked about the question, it was like, you know, you shouldn't have asked them about it because, you know, they weren't prepared for it. So, you know, that's just kind of like, I was a little confused about that. But what I wanted to say is that when they were talking about, I think that using the term misogyny is a deflectionary tactic that white supremacist suspects use to take us off of, instead of dealing with white supremacy, if they can throw in their own agenda, anything that should deflect. And they were talking about, like, when you were talking about, like, what was the... the toolbox about that's what they wrote about, and they were talking about they start bringing up misogyny, then they start LGBT, and then it's like everything gets pushed, white supremacy is pushed out of the way, racism gets pushed out of the way, and all those other things become more important than what the actual problem is, which is white supremacy. So with the misogyny thing, I would say, because I listened to your the archives today, the archive that you had regarding Holtzclaw, what is his first name?
Daniel Holtzclaw? That's who you're talking about? The raping? Okay.
Yeah, Daniel, yes. You had the lady, she was, what was her name, the lady, the guest that you had on the show that was asked, that you asked, that was a very good program. What was the guest name that you had on the program? And she was giving you guys more details about, it was a
OKC Artist for Justice? OKC Artist for Justice?
Yes. Yes, and what was her name, Gal, or was it Gal?
Give me one. I told you now, my memory is not perfect now. And this was, same thing, this was, you know, not planned. So give me a second and I'll double check.
If I can look and see if I can go back on, because I was listening to it on Stitcher. And I can go back and see real quick what her name was. But that program, now this guy, he, you know, he actually went out and he targeted, even though he was supposed to be a so-called biracial, but he still mainly was identifying as white. And his whole thing was he was going out targeting black women who were, I guess for lack of a better word, who was in the ghettos and, you know, using drugs and things like that. So I wonder what they would say in a case like that when a person like this man specifically was going out targeting black women, no other women within a certain class. So would that be misogyny or would that be white supremacy racist?
Grace Franklin, OKC Artist for Justice, March 2015, and then she came back again after the trial started later, towards the end of that year. She came back and did the follow-up because they were going and giving updates at the courtroom and all the rest of it. But Grace Franklin, black female, March 19, 2015, been here a long time. Relatively.
Yeah, that was that show had me so, I was like, because I've heard you talk about, like, this case on, you know, on the program, but when she talked about the details of this case and how he was actually going out here targeting these women, it's like, you know, so, like, I wonder, like, what's your guess? How would they categorize this, his actions? Would they say that he was being, I guess they would say he was being misogynistic instead of racist. I think he was being racist, you know, because he was going out intentionally targeting black women. So, you know, it's just, I just don't like when they try to take, you know, they try to act like they're trying to help out. But then it's like they have an agenda. So, you know, and then it's like the rushing off the phone. Like, you all of a sudden, you have to go. And then, like, the other caller said, the other one had to go, too. So, I don't know. It just seems like they're playing games. Like, they really are not really trying to solve the problem. And that's all I had to share.
Much obliged, Draptomania. That was important program, March 19, 2015. Looky there. Almost to the date. March 19, 2015. OKC Artists for Justice, Grace Franklin. Great information. Oh, and they're twice, I guess, if you want to get the double dip, you can listen to that one first and then roll all the way forward to December of the same year and hear when she came back again. And you'll be hearing what was happening during the trial. And where he also, that would be a cowbell, Daniel Holtzclaw, one white parent, one non-white parent. We talked about that as well.
Yeah, I said that. Mm-hmm. It's just like the guy that killed all those people that they put in the book that they didn't want to discuss. It's the same exact situation.
Context of white supremacy. Other folks, comments, questions, much obliged, Draptomania.
Can I be heard again?
Retired firefighter, yes sir.
Yes, sir. I just wanted to share before the program ends, Mr. Fuller's definition, not definition, but his insight on the word nationalism. He does have it in the word guide. Is it okay?
Oh, let's hear it.
Use this word with caution. During the existence of white supremacy racism, use this word to apply to the white nation, the race nation, the nation of white supremacists collectively. When others use the words nation, nationalism, etc., ask for a detailed explanation that you can easily understand. Ask them to explain in detail the correct purpose for the existence of a nation and the correct purpose for the existence of the concept of nationalism. The last but not least, the only other closest thing that I've picked up in the word guide is something that he calls white nation. And he has to use this term to apply to, number one, any one or more white persons who practice white supremacy racism. Number two, the sum total of all speech and action by those white persons who practice white supremacy in any one or more areas of activity, and or number three, white supremacists collectively. So that's basically what give insight or a definition to this term that they brought up, white nationalism. And the only thing that she put next to it was it's political, whatever that means.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Excellent input, Mr. Fuller's Word Guide, producejustice.com. Get your copies, share, study, producejustice.com. The white nation. Absolutely. That racial focal pointing, say that again, man. It's so important. Like, I think just there's so much confusion anyway about what it means to be classified as white. What it means when we say racism, white supremacy. I mean, like I said, their definition, racism, white supremacy is controlling the rights of white women. Of course, that's going to cause confusion when we're talking. You got a white woman telling you that racism means controlling her rights. That's racism. Anyway, when you try to weave through all of that confusion, asking questions as best you can, that nationalism, many components of that, it has the same effect. Whether it's white women are also victims of racism, they're not perpetrators. It gets narrowed. You got white nationalism, so it's Richard Spencer. This is the problem. Richard Spencer and alt-right and 4chan and all the rest of it. These are the problems. Not, wait a minute, we're in a system of racism, white supremacy. Yes, this might be one component, but I mean... We're in a global system, all areas of people activity, all over the land, not just this country, all over the world. That's what we're dealing with. I'm not even saying a toolkit is great. We should have a resource like that. I'm just saying, but if we're serious, then it should, you know, be using correct terms to describe this problem. Because, I mean, it's a wealth of racist activity beyond Richard Spencer and all the rest of it. And white women certainly are not victims of racism, white supremacy. Like, accuracy is important if we're serious about solving this problem. Was it caller in New Jersey? Did you have something you were going to share?
Because we were just talking about just confusion and also motive. And I suspect that, you know, their work is not necessarily to solve the problem. It's just for glory and acumen, you know, just you know, maybe just a pat on the back, financial gain, and just also the free black people. So that's the conclusion that I came to. So if they came on the show and the black callers and the black host, Gus, would just, you know, just so thrilled about them, you know, trying to address racism in schools, they probably would have stayed another hour. But that's not really what they got. And stand by your work. So when they encountered callers and the host that questioned them on their work, it was something that they couldn't stand on. So again, this is why they ran. And again, this isn't, again, like I'll conclude, their work is not to solve racism and white supremacy. It's just basically for money and accolades. That's my conclusion.
Words of the day. Stand by your work. White people spend a lot of time and energy giving the appearance that they are serious about ending racism. That is a conclusion I have reached to them. That takes a whole lot of manifestations, like the Occupy Wall Street a few years back, Woodstock and the hippies and all that from the 60s, the Weather Underground and all that, as the Students for Democratic Society. That takes a lot of this so-called the communist and socialist movement in the 1930s. That takes a lot of John Brown, the legend. That takes a lot of different forms. White people giving the appearance, progressives in the South at the time of Ben Pitchfork Tillman. Many different eras where white people give the appearance that they are not racist, that they are against the system of white supremacy. Evidence has shown that that is not the case. They can be very tricky. Deception. Any other last quick comment or folks satisfied? We'll be here Thursday, book club, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, Chicago again, packing them in, environmental racism, getting close to the end of the text, but we'll be here at minimum Thursday. Might be here before then. We'll have to see. Stay tuned. Any final comments?
Can I be heard?
Caller in Florida.
Oh, yes, sir. Thank you very much. Speaking of words, it made me think about something. As far as the recent reports on the COVID-19 virus, it made me think when the president was saying the Chinese virus, I also heard him say, he used the term war. And people are saying this is a war zone, and, you know, we're on the front lines. And he said it's an unseen enemy. And then I thought, wait a minute, no, it ain't unseen, because he's talking about Chinese virus. So that's it. See, this is why it's important, you know, and I appreciate you for having this program, because this is definitely connected to racism, white supremacy. And they definitely don't stop with the language, and they still are, they're projecting that it's going to be up to almost 200,000 deaths. It's like they enjoy this type of thing. They already have the numbers on this already. Like that's a sick mind to think that. That's just my opinion on that. But yeah, they're using terms like war, and here locally they use the word
retail friction when they are only allowing a certain amount of people inside. And one last thing, they practice racism on the local news station by saying, that, oh, well, you know, the black people, they're having this block party, you know, hey, we want social distancing. But on the very next report, it's people in what they call Guinea Springs or something like that. And it's a bunch of white people, and they're in the swimming pools, and they are not practicing social distancing, but they made it seem like that's celebratory for them. Well, you know, we're tired of being cooped up in a house. So the racism still continues. And that's all I have for now. Thanks for allowing me to share.
Much obliged, caller in Florida. Everybody knows black people are not taking this seriously. We don't take anything serious. Now, that is a component of racism where we are not taking this problem seriously. But, yeah, that is the same question that I've had. Not taking this seriously in comparison to whom exactly? Because I have seen a lot of that. White people all over the world, in fact. White people partying and still taking plane rides places and all types of different activities that is not social distancing and what have you. They're still hanging out and doing their thing. Not all of them, but I've seen a healthy amount of that. And worldwide, like I said, England, they didn't even shut down until last week. You could still go to the bar and all that until the freaking prime minister, Boris Johnson, he got mentioned. He got a teaspoon of the virus. So, I mean, in comparison to who exactly? When people say black people are not taking it serious, I'm not surprised by a report by that. Like, yes, look at the Negros. Vector, look at that. The Negros. Yeah, what did she say? The caller who dialed in before they said their child or the white teacher, I think, white child, they had been trained. They would see brown and ew. Like, that could be hooked up right now to deal with all of this. But anyway. We are at our 3-hour mark. As I'm not sure if we'll be on for Tuesday, Wednesday. I'm thinking we probably won't be on tomorrow, but we'll be back for Wednesday. I think that will probably be the way it'll go. Have to stay tuned for details. Facebook, Black Talk Radio Network, all the rest of it. Definitely here for Thursday. Book club, absolutely. And then workplace racism on Friday. Compensatory call-in on Saturday. Dr. Ruby Lathan, she should be back with us on the 8th. I think that's next Tuesday. I have to pull up my calendar. It's next Wednesday. Next Wednesday. Dr. Lathan will be back with us talking about ways that you can cook. Prepare meals, do some working out in the kitchen during the middle of all this to eat better. Again, I was horrified. I emailed her in New Orleans where they said that black people, or they didn't say black people, they just said New Orleanians in general are less healthy. And they listed all of the chronic problems, diabetes and hypertension, high blood pressure and all the rest of it. A lot of that stuff is directly related to diet and eating trash, and that's what race soldiers inundate us with, trash. And you end up being sick and all the rest of it and having a compromised immune system. Quality eating, that's why I've been doing my posts, pictures, healthy eating. I had vegan eggplant parmesan yesterday, asparagus, broccoli. It was amazing. Today I went downstairs, I was prepping for the program. I had finished reading the toolkit and trying to get my questions and everything together. I went downstairs. I was hungry, but I wasn't sure what I wanted to eat. Literally, I opened the door. It was an Amazon package with 6 pounds of hemp seeds. I had that on my wish list. I said, oh my God, that was exact message because I am hungry. I got 6 pounds, no less, of hemp seeds. I should make a smoothie. So that's what I did. Got charged up fresh ginger. I said that before. Lots of fresh fruits and vegetables, eating better, taking care of your body strengthens your, that is taking this seriously. I'm going to eat well so that my body, my immune system is really strong, so that I can fight off any germs, or what have you that should come in and invade. Cause that's what they said in that New Orleans, the Times-Picayune report in New Orleans, that folks who get it been eating bad food, not in good health. compromised immune system, not going to be able to fight this off. You will be much more likely to have a fatal problem with the Chinese virus. That was what I read. Like I said, that really stuck out to me because I hadn't really heard anything like that before. They had just said that old people were at risk and, you know, folks who had a compromised immune system. They didn't include all the other details, but eat well, use logic. So we'll be here minimum Thursday, I think Wednesday, though. Just check Black Talk Radio Network Facebook page for details, and we'll see. Again, if folks, anybody is on the, hey, you should not be talking about this. We can put this on hold until, you know, things calm down a bit. There's a pandemic on the planet, and, you know, you should be talking about, you know, face masks or something related to the virus. I did think about that. That is valid. So if anybody, that is your perspective, feel free to email and let me know, because we should not be wasting time and energy under emergency conditions. That said, we should be here Thursday. Much obliged for folks tuning in. Hope it was worthy of your Monday evening for sure. Man, sobriety would be best. Liquor stores and all that are open. I heard lots of excuses about that. They said they had in Washington State, many of the recreational establishments are considered essential businesses. Recreational. They have the medicinal too, but the recreational. Now, I do understand that many people say, and there are lots of reports that, you know, it has medicinal properties and you can get CBD products and all that to help for pain management, nausea, and all the rest of it. Not disputing that at all. I'm just saying, the same way with the liquor store. I've been by many liquor stores in my time on the planet. I don't think most of the patrons are going for anything medicinal. It's under beverage. That's how they get their essential. It's under beverage, food and alcohol beverage control, right? That's how it's listed offered. But I don't think people are going there for beverages like water or a soda pop. I don't think that's the case. And the same thing with the dispensary. I don't think most people are going for pain management. I could be totally wrong, but anyway, that is essential. I would say the same thing that I said before all of this. Sobriety would be best. In addition to being sober, we shouldn't be doing a whole lot. I'll say that again. Man, under these times, that would be the one edit. Man, it should be real strategic if you are going out, especially if it's dark. That's why I said I was going to go to the grocery store. It's dark now. That was what made me reconsider. I am not really interested in doing a whole lot of walking around, driving around, anything around. If it's dark, I mean, it should be like with emergency, like you should do your shopping in the daytime. You do not want to be out and about and have something happen, be stopped and questioned. Like a lot of regions, they're under stop and shelter. And that has been confusing in different regions in terms of what does that mean? And are you allowed to go out and where are you allowed to go and all the rest of it? I would encourage you probably should stay in once it gets dark. There are a lot of armed white people. Some people live in regions where you can have armed like white sentinels where they can just be out with no badge and can just be out roaming the vicinity, can stop you. What are you doing? Why are you traveling? Where are you going? Type of a thing. I would take all that in mind. You probably have a lot of very anxious, stressed race soldiers. And sometimes they might just be looking for an excuse. Got that new firearm. Want to brandish it. Show my power, flex my muscle. Keep that in mind. Be very strategic. That would be what I would say when you're going to go out. And I would really try to avoid being out at night. Try to get everything that you can done in the daytime and then just be in. Not virus. That is a good reason too. But racism, white supremacy, the pandemic, that is a really good reason. With all of these armed white people, stay in the house once the sun goes down. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.